This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Read you a tweet, June 29th, 2020. What is that? A year and a half ago, right? About that. This is a tweet that it's a pretty simple tweet, a very powerful tweet. End mass incarceration. Period after each word. Defund the prison industrial complex. Now I got to be honest, and this is where I part company from many of my friends that are conservatives that want to just keep everybody in jail forever. There's not a word there I disagree with. That tweet is from Congressman Hakeem Jeffries, an up-and-coming Brooklyn Democratic congressman, rising star in Washington. And that was June 29th, 2020. Let me repeat it for you. End mass incarceration, defund the prison industrial complex. Now, let me read you a tweet from 4:30 yesterday afternoon. Lock up Kyle Rittenhouse and throw away the key. That tweet also from Hakeem Jeffries. Now, these two thoughts are completely incompatible with one another. You cannot be for ending the prison industrial complex, defunding the prison industrial complex, ending mass incarceration, and at the same time saying lock Kyle Rittenhouse up and throw away the key. So I responded to this tweet from Hakeem Jeffries. I was talking about Eric Adams with Dominic before, so I still have Eric Adams things on the brain that I'm going to comment on later. I responded to this tweet from Hakeem Jeffries, and I said, well, wait a minute. What about waiting to see what the actual verdict is? I have not followed the Kyle Rittenhouse trial terribly closely, in part because all of the news is so depressing. You're talking about a couple of people being killed by a young man, which is sad. Then you're talking about people that were there rioting and looting in the street. That was sad. Over the killing of another man. That was sad. In the height of what was happening in the country in the aftermath of George Floyd, which was sad. So it's just, it's a bundle of sadness. Also, whenever you have a white person that shoots and kills black people, there's this whole racial element to these stories that I don't like commenting on because, in my view, so often it brings out the worst in people. It also tends to become inflammatory, and you hear people just repeating the same arguments without paying any attention to what's going on in the case. That wasn't until yesterday when Kyle Rittenhouse testified in his own defense yesterday. Now, this is a 17-year-old young man. And this is a portion of his testimony.
There were three people right there.
Take a deep breath, Kyle.
That's what I... That's what I run.
Now, Kyle Rittenhouse, obviously 17-year-old young man, not even old enough to vote, not old enough to drink. And he is clearly very emotional as he's talking about this experience, which he came across as a very credible witness that did believe that his life was threatened and did believe that he committed these killings as a result of self-defense. And here he was being questioned by his attorney about what he was seeking to do down there. Why was he carrying around this AR-15 in the first place?
On August 25th of 2020, did you come to downtown Kenosha to look for trouble?
No.
Would you have shot Joseph Rosenbaum if he hadn't chased you trying to take your firearm?
Objection, reading.
That sounds unsettling.
Then the defense got Rittenhouse talking about what led to him firing his weapon.
The only type of stuff that happened was the person that attacked me first threatened to kill me twice.
Okay. And the person who threatened to kill you, we now know, is Mr. Rosenbaum, correct?
Yes.
Now, this is a sad situation. My heart goes out for everybody involved. And the judge was incredibly hostile. Judge Bruce Schroeder, who is an older guy, he's a pretty by-the-book judge, but he's a guy that has a pretty good reputation. Judge Bruce Schroeder reprimanded the assistant district attorney, Thomas Binger, yesterday for his line of questioning while cross-examining Kyle Rittenhouse. So apparently, this is what the judge said. I was astonished when you began your examination by commenting on the defendant's post-arrest silence. This was after the jury left the courtroom. That's basic law. It's been basic law in this country for 40 years, 50 years. I have no idea why you would do something like that. You know very well that an attorney can't go into these types of areas when the judge has already ruled without asking outside the presence of the jury to do so. So don't give me that. That's number one. So following this contentious exchange, the defense attorneys made a request for a mistrial. Now, here's what was interesting. They made a request for a mistrial with prejudice, which means that if there's a new that they can't bring charges again. The judge apparently did not go for that, but he is still considering ruling on a mistrial because this is a pretty serious thing what the prosecutor did. While he was cross-examining Mr. Rittenhouse, he tried to ask him about, in words or substance, why he was remaining silent. So if the mistrial was caused by the prosecution because they think they're losing the case, then the court might, you know, take a dim view on that. Even if they do allow Rittenhouse to be tried again, I doubt that they would allow Binger, the assistant DA, to be the one that brings the case. But I have to tell you, after reading a lot of analysis, listening to a lot of analysis about this case today, watching a good portion of the testimony, I have to say there is no way, and you could take this to the bank. Those of you, we may do the AC report later. You can bet on this, right? There is no way in the world that this trial ends in a conviction. None. None whatsoever. This trial will either be a mistrial or an acquittal. And it is almost inconceivable that these charges would have been filed if we were not in the political climate that we're in, and if we weren't in an era where there are so many people, including members of Congress like Hakeem Jeffries and some others, calling for charges to be brought on social media, which is very alarming. We're supposed to have a system of laws in this country. We have indictment by grand jury, not indictment by Twitter. And I have rarely seen a judge. I've observed a lot of cases, but I'm going to go ahead and say I've never seen a judge this hostile to the prosecution before. It's not done, so we'll see. But this is really extraordinary. And if you look at how the media portrayed this case in the beginning, and now what we're seeing play out in the courtroom, this is night and day. This is absolutely night and day. There is a huge gap between the media narrative about this and what actually happened. And Ryan Grimm, who I think writes for The Intercept, who's not a conservative by any means, and again, this shouldn't even be a political issue. We're talking about a young man on trial for murder, and if he's convicted, he'll be sent to prison for the rest of his life. Ryan Grimm said, I mean it when I say that we'd have a better criminal justice system if every judge was as hostile to the prosecution as Rittenhouse's judge is to his prosecutor. Of course, we don't have that system. Meanwhile, this is all Ryan Grimm. Again, wrote for the Huffington Post, I think writes still for The Intercept, a very left of center guy. Meanwhile, the media did a real disservice to people who are going to be shocked at an acquittal and assumed he was acquitted because of a biased judge, when really it's the video that shows him acting in those moments in self-defense under the law. That's exactly right. There is no way, take it to the bank, there is no way this trial ends in a conviction. So there is no way you can watch this trial, look into the evidence, listen to the testimony, and think that the prosecution has proved their case beyond a reasonable doubt. There's no way. No way. So, and, you know, you compare this to what we saw, not only from, so Hakeem Jeffries is the chairman of the House Democratic Caucus. That is a very progressive group. That is the leading caucus within a body of Congress that is the majority body. So he's saying lock up Kyle Rittenhouse and throw away the key. Shouldn't his view, shouldn't the view of the House Democratic Caucus be something like, if convicted, lock Kyle Rittenhouse up and throw away the key? How about due process? How about trials? For a party that wants to end mass incarceration, supposedly, they seem awfully quick to want to incarcerate Kyle Rittenhouse. And you have to wonder why. Now, I think the answer is clear, unfortunately, and I don't like to play this game of, oh, life is so unfair to people who are conservative, life is so unfair to people that are liberal. They're reacting this way because Kyle Rittenhouse does not share their political views, because this is a right-wing guy. There's no problem with seeing him go to prison for the rest of his life. And that's the real shame of this, because when you have principles, they should mean something no matter how those principles fall. I've tried to live by that code, not always successfully, but, you know, I'm not fond of Andrew Cuomo. And I told you that that case against him was a dog. I told you that wasn't going anywhere. This case doesn't matter your politics. This case is going absolutely nowhere. Hakeem Jeffries was one of the leading advocates in this country for criminal justice reform, prison abolition, the inherent pro-prosecution bias. What happened to that guy? Now Hakeem Jeffries is lock him up and throw away the key? No, no, no. Doesn't fly. This case will be an acquittal or a mistrial. August 26, 2020. Let me read you another tweet from another member of Congress. A 17-year-old white supremacist domestic terrorist drove across state lines armed with an AR-15. He shot and killed two people who had assembled to affirm the value, dignity, and worth of black lives. Fix your damn headlines. That tweet is from Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. If you've watched this trial, none of the evidence presented remotely vindicate the claims made in that tweet, which went viral. It was liked by 3,000 people. It's been retweeted by 592 people. None of the evidence supports that. So what I would say to all of the politicians in our audience, and we have many out there, you're all concerned with Facebook disinformation. You're all concerned with fake news. Fake news is not the problem here. Facebook disinformation is not the problem here. You're the problem. You are lying. You are distorting the facts. And there's no, there's nothing wrong with saying when somebody's shot, God forbid, there's nothing wrong in saying, let's wait and see what the evidence shows. And Ayanna Pressley didn't do that. Hakeem Jeffries is apparently just putting his fingers in his ears. He doesn't care what the evidence shows, because this Kyle Rittenhouse prosecution is a joke and it should end in a swift acquittal. I guarantee you it will. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Comment as you see fit. It is Veterans Day, and I want to stay focused mostly on veterans. So we have a lot of great Veterans Day guests today. One of my all-time favorites, Colonel Daniel Davis, is going to be here. We're going to talk about Taiwan, China, what's happening in the world today, national security in general. In the 2 o'clock hour, Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Randall is going to be here. And I am really looking forward to talking with Frank Romeo in the 3 o'clock hour. He's in the midst of a walk to draw attention to PTSD. He's a veteran that has been suffering with PTSD for 50 years. And then in the 4 o'clock hour, Assemblyman Kieran Lawler is going to be here. He is a state assemblyman, but he's also a Marine veteran of the Iraq War. We're going to talk about a whole bunch of things with him. And we'll find a way to squeeze in the AC report as well. 800-848-WABC. Let me begin with Jennifer in Boston, because she was holding yesterday. We never got to her. Hello, Jennifer.
Hey, thanks so much, Frank. I just want to say two things quickly, one on the veterans and one on Rittenhouse, if I could. As far as Rittenhouse goes, I think it's absolutely heartbreaking for him and his family that they took this thing to trial. And I pray that justice will be done and that he will be, released. You look at what that cop did to the Australian woman, Justine. Remember the Somalian cop?
Yes. Yeah, I don't remember the name of the woman, unfortunately.
Yeah, her name is Justine. So God, anyway, God love her. And she called the police, the whole thing. She walks out to the car and he just blasts her dead, Frank. He killed her right there on the spot, leaned over his fellow cop that was in the driver's seat.
Yeah, it's outrageous. Outrageous.
Okay, but just, do you know that just a couple of days ago, the third degree murder charge on him was dropped?
I did see that. Yeah, no, it's crazy. I mean, it's a tremendous miscarriage of justice.
So I'm just, things are going very, very wrong in this country. And there's video evidence to back up everything Rittenhouse says. And yet these loonies in the media are just, people have lost in politics. Ayanna Pressley, she represents us here in such a poor fashion. It's an embarrassment. But real quick, on the veterans, I heard you speak about this gentleman with PTSD and how long he suffered, bless him. And I just wanted to make people aware that the VA, a lot, because I actually helped a gentleman with this that was long suffering with PTSD, and he had remarkable results. And if I never do anything good in my life, Frank, other than that, I'll feel good. There's a therapy, and the VA offers, it was actually started at the VA, but sadly a lot of veterans don't know. It's called EMDR therapy, EMDR, and it's for trauma. It's a trauma-based therapy, and it's very, very easy to do. And people, obviously not everything works for everyone, but it has a really, really good track record with veterans. And well, I would encourage anyone in need, because as you know, there's 22 a day taking their lives.
I do. Yes, we're gonna be chatting about the problem with veteran suicide specifically throughout the day. Jennifer, what is your profession? You sound so energetic and interesting and intelligent, even when you disagree with me and try and drive me crazy. You're always interesting.
I try to drive you crazy in the nicest way possible.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
I actually worked in nursing and cardiology for years, and now due to my own health things, I'm not working yet.
Oh, well, I wish you a speedy recovery. Hopefully you'll get back to work soon, but not too soon, because we still need you listening to this show and busting my chops.
I'm motivating you here and there, but I really thank you. I truly do, and I thank you for honoring the veterans and giving them a voice and bringing attention, especially to the suicide and the PTSD, because it's really like a – talk about an epidemic. You know, they said that when the whole race riots were going on, what was that last year? You know, they said that it's a public health crisis. Well, if what's happening to these veterans and our cops in this country isn't a crisis with the suicide, I don't know what is.
No, that is for sure. Thank you very much. 800-848-WABC. Michael is in New Jersey. Hello, Michael.
Yeah, I totally 100,000,000% agree with you. He should be found innocent.
Nobody gets found innocent. You get found not guilty.
Not guilty. Well, here's the thing. The only reason they're going after him, like you said, is for two reasons. He's a conservative, and to be perfectly honest, he's white. Let's call it the way it is. And hopefully, what you're predicting will come true. But here's the thing. If they find him innocent,
Not guilty.
We're going to have riots. They're going to start burning stores, looting, stealing, the whole nonsense.
Well, I hope you're wrong, Michael.
I hope so, too.
I hope you're wrong. But and here's why I think you might be. Because, and this is one of the reasons I've always been an advocate of cameras in the courtroom. Because the fact that the country is getting to see what goes on in this trial, I mean, if this was a Rodney King type situation where the cops were clearly guilty and they escaped conviction, then there would be riots. But there's no way you can look at the evidence in this case and think that he's guilty. And no reasonable person can think the prosecution proved their case beyond a reasonable doubt. You can't. The evidence, there's nothing in the evidence that suggests that. 800-848-WABC. Paul is in the Bronx. Hello, Paul.
The problem, Frank, you know, I'm a retired NYPD detective, is that prosecutors are immune from criminal and civil prosecution. You know the classic example, twistedjustice@cnn.com.
800-848-WABC. Dara is in Saratoga. Hello, Dara.
Hi, Frank. So I do believe facts matter, and we must really wait for the end of this entire trial.
That's fair.
With that.
Well, the trial may end tomorrow with a mistrial because of this prosecutor's conduct in court yesterday.
Well, I don't think that's going to happen. I watched the trial today, and I think that this judge is just looking for his moment. Anyway, let's look at the facts. There's a 17-year-old deputized by nobody, under the supervision of nobody, out there protecting community, I don't know, during riots, you know, but really violent riots. He was laid off from the YMCA lifeguard job of 1 week, right? He's homeschooled. He's a player of video game shooter games. His older friend purchased a Smith & Wesson M&P-15. Now, that's a military-style weapon. Now, I don't want no 17-year-old laid off from the YMCA with no shooter training holding a Smith & Wesson in front of me. Now, he doesn't know the difference between a full metal jacket ammunition or his hollow point bullets. By the way, he had hollow points, 30, full magazine, loaded, chamber, okay? A live round in the chamber, and he doesn't even know what kind of ammunition he's carried in this gun, because guess what? In that state, he's not allowed to have that gun. He was a fire department cadet trained in first aid, and guess what? He shot three people that day. Three people he unloaded on didn't render aid to any of them.
Well,
even take a pulse.
For starters, I'm not going to defend him running around with an AR-15. I don't think that's wise for any untrained 17-year-old to do. Number two, there's no question about it that this young man is a bit of a cop buff or a wannabe police officer. That being said, that doesn't justify a life sentence for murder, given what the video shows and given what the testimony has shown.
He's a walking manslaughter case. And I'll tell you what, he's a victim of this society. He's a child of a broken home going between his mother and his father's house. He had no guidance. He has no supervision in his life. I look at him as a lost kid. And by the way, his crocodile tears today served no one. No one. In fact, I'm an untrained person, but I've worked with this society of people. He looks like he might be on the spectrum. And I think instead of putting him on the stand today, his lawyer would have done well to go another route and get some psychological analysis of him, because this kid ain't right.
Well, look, I disagree with you on the – first of all, I'm not going to quibble with whether or not he's on the spectrum or not. There's no way to know. No way for me to know. I'm not a professional. I completely disagree with you on your characterization of his crying as crocodile tears. I think that the testimony came across as very sincere. I thought he came across as very credible. Even when the prosecutors were trying to trip him up on cross-examination, I thought the missteps that he made while trying to answer the questions came across as very sincere. And the fact that the mother was also crying at the same time, I don't know. I would have a tough time believing that that he was crying on cue. I don't believe that at all. Personally, I found that the testimony was credible. And It matches the video evidence that we have. So, I mean, so far we haven't heard testimony from somebody that has said that these people didn't threaten to kill him. They threatened to kill him. And it's, look, he shouldn't have been there with an AR-15. I'll grant you that. Shouldn't have been trying to play Joe Vigilante. I'll grant you that. But if you go up to someone and threaten to kill them while they're holding an AR-15, you have a pretty good idea of what's going to happen to you. And again, I'm not trying to blame the people that were killed here, but I'm saying if you look at the criminal definition of self-defense, this clearly fits it, in my judgment. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Let me say hello to Neil on Staten Island. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Frank. I also watched the trial today. And I got to tell you, Frank, I was dumbfounded by that prosecutor. I've never seen a bigger moron in my life. When he says to him, he had a pistol in his hand, and you shot him first. Do you think it's right that you shot him first? Before? What did he expect? You wait for him to shoot him and then to try to shoot him back? I mean, the guy's an absolute moron. What a trial. What a trial.
I think if we weren't in the political climate that we're in and the social media climate that we're in with members of Congress calling for this kid's scalp, I don't think this case ever would have gone to trial, personally. 800-848-9222. Let all Neils be heard from. Let's go to Neil in Manhattan. Hello, Neil.
Oh, this is Leo.
Rio. Okay. Hello, Rio.
Yeah, how are you doing? I just wanted to respond to the previous caller. Number one, she have no idea how it feels when you actually take somebody's life. How your mentality is, no matter which way it happened, if it's in military or if it's in case of self-defense, how you are mentally touched. So I'm talking, responding to her comments about the crocodile tears. And another point I would like to do is, if that kid would not have the weapon with him that day, he would maybe die. He would not maybe.
Right, but I guess the question is, and I appreciate the call, Rio. I guess the question is, did he really need to make the trip to go there to protect people? I don't know. I probably not. He could have stayed home, not brought his AR-15. However, that doesn't mean he's guilty of murder. And if he's convicted, then he will face the rest of his life in prison. It's crazy. It's crazy. Can't happen. Won't happen. All right. It is Veterans Day. So we're going to talk with one of my favorite military minds in the whole country, Colonel Daniel Davis, author of a terrific book that really lays out the national security threats our country is facing. He's also a senior fellow for Defense Priorities, one of my favorite think tanks. We're going to talk about the situation in Asia, what's happening with Taiwan, China, North Korea, and we'll talk a little bit about Veterans Day in general. So stay tuned for that. This is The Other Side of Midnight, straight ahead.
77 WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano. 77 WABC.
On the boats and on the planes, they're coming to America, never looking back again. Don't it seem so far away? We're traveling light today. In the eye of the storm.
In the eye Neil Diamond, of the storm. America, and a big part of the reason America gets to continue being America is because of the men and women who have bravely served this country in the United States military. One of my absolute favorite among them is the author of the book, The 11th Hour in 2020 America, How America's Foreign Policy Got Jacked Up and How the Next Administration Can Fix It, Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis. He is a decorated Army veteran. with deployments in four combat zones. And these days, he also serves as a senior fellow and military expert for defense priorities. Colonel Davis, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate starting off Veterans Day with you.
Hey, thanks a lot, Frank. I always love being on your show. Thanks for having me.
Colonel, because you're my resident expert in terms of military etiquette, military decorum, is it appropriate to say Happy Veterans Day? I mean, there's something that seems maybe, I don't know, a little odd about it. Is that the respectful greeting that I should give a veteran?
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, I think it is because, you know, the whole point of the holiday is to commemorate the service that so many people have given, and, you know, and especially those who have given the last full measure and their family members. So, yeah, I think it is.
Now, here's where the questions get really tricky, Colonel. Where does the apostrophe go in veterans, if anywhere? Is it between the N and the S? Is it after the S, or is there no apostrophe?
You know, I actually just found out from my editor that there is no apostrophe. It's just an S. And I've been doing it wrong for like all most of my life until just a couple of days ago.
All right. Well, okay. See, I'm glad you learned for all of us. All right. Let's talk about what's going on in North Korea. We're seeing North Korean hackers target the South's think tanks through blog posts. We're seeing reports that North Korea is intensifying their war against foreign influence. We're seeing very worrisome reports that they are expanding their missile arsenal. We've already seen reports of more nuclear tests on the part of North Korea. How concerned are you in terms of North Korea being a national security threat to America?
You know, I'm actually not concerned in the least. I actually just published something a couple of days ago in The Guardian discussing all these very issues right there. And, you know, the truth is that North Korea is going to continue to modernize and upkeep their ballistic missile force, just like every country does. None of these things have added any capacity that they haven't had for decades. And so and there hasn't been any additional nuclear testing since President Trump arranged that deal with Kim Jong-un to cease the ICBM test or the nuclear test. He has been good to his word, and he hasn't done any since then, even though Trump's no longer in office. So we can be thankful for that. But there's no reason to think that North Korea is suddenly going to stop doing any testing, stop doing any kind of even missile upkeep. But the big time reality is that we are under no threat of attack from North Korea, because he knows that if he does anything, whether conventional or nuclear, that we will respond tenfold to what he might do, and he would be wiped out, and he'll never do that. North Korea uses their nuclear force, especially as a deterrent to keep us from invading, and that's it.
This is such an important point that you raise in your piece for The Guardian and in what you just said, because I think the perception that a lot of Americans have of Kim Jong-un is, and this is a perception that has only been fed by the media, is that he's some sort of a James Bond-style comic book villain, maniacal, sitting, twiddling his thumbs, waiting to crush the globe in a giant halo of holy hellfire. But you believe that Kim Jong-un and the Korean regime is actually rational and wouldn't take such an aggressive step because they'd be wiped out.
100%. I couldn't have said it better myself than all the things you just did there. That's absolutely correct. The absolute overriding number one imperative for the North Korean regime, as it's been through all three of the Kim since 1949, is regime survival. So they will do everything in their power to keep in power. And by using a nuclear weapon would completely upend that by basically committing suicide. And there's no way they're going to do that. They want these things so that their regime will continue going on into future decades, not to have them destroy themselves.
Okay, let's talk about China. China had made a lot of news recently for developing this hypersonic missile. Apparently, some folks here in the United States intelligence community were pretty concerned because we didn't think China had this kind of technology yet. How concerned should we be about China's development of this hypersonic missile?
You know, I got to tell you, this is one of the biggest puzzles that I just hadn't yet been able to figure out. of late, and especially when the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Milley, is making the comments about how we're surprised and there's this dramatic advancement or whatever. Look, since 2015, the Defense Department's old report to Congress, public, we're not talking about classified here, has been talking about Chinese advancement in hypersonic missiles specifically. And even generally, going back even many years beyond that, there's been a very methodical talking about and detail about how the Chinese military is growing and developing, how much they're spending, what they're building. I mean, no one who's paying any attention could be surprised by this. And for the senior militaries to act like with alarm, like something unusual has happened that we didn't know, is troubling, because I've known, I'm just because I read their reports. So if they're not reading their own reports, then that's another level of trouble.
So what's your take on why General Milley would either be surprised or act so surprised? What's all that about? I mean, I can't imagine he didn't know if that information is as readily available as you make it sound.
Exactly. I mean, it's literally, it's his own publication from the Department of Defense. The only thing I can, and all I can do is speculate because, you know, he didn't tell me. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think as we talked about on one of the, maybe the last time I was on your show, we were talking about Afghanistan specifically. I mean, frankly, General Milley has had a lot of bad decisions. And his judgment has been really bad in several areas. And this is one of the reasons why I was so concerned about his judgment in Afghanistan and before, because what happens when it comes to something that really matters, like the potential for war with China or the potential for war with Russia? There's a bunch of things going on in that realm as well. And when he's talking, you know, alarmist like this, when there shouldn't be any alarm, what's he going to do if it comes to a crisis situation? And that's, I think there's some serious concern there. And I'd really like to see Biden find himself a new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Do you think, because of the disaster of the Afghanistan pullout, that perhaps this was his attempt to say, OK, you don't have to pay attention to what's going on in Afghanistan. Don't look at that. Look at this bright, shiny new crisis that China's cooking up. That's what we should pay attention to, diverting the attention of the public and the press and policymakers in Washington to the Chinese problem rather than the Afghan situation.
I mean, you can't dispute that. I mean, you can't just rule it out. Again, I don't know. All I can do is speculate. You know, there's certainly a lot of people say, well, they're hyping up the China threat so that they can get more and more money because, you know, now that they're out of Afghanistan, there's going to be some understandable movement on Congress to say, hey, why do we need this continually huge budget when we're no longer even fighting the war over there? And so the answer is going to be, oh, well, we need $6 billion more per year to go and do stuff in China. And my goodness, look at the threat. You know, they got to justify it somehow. So I don't think you could rule out that that's a possibility.
Just going back to your Guardian piece on the Asian situation in general, and I want to encourage people to read it. I just retweeted it. They can find it on my Twitter, at Frank Morano. That's Frank, M-O-R-A-N-O. I'm going to put it on my Facebook page as well, facebook.com/MoranoFan. You write that a maximalist policy that demands North Korea denuclearize before the U.S. offers anything in return would be a mistake. Now, why? A lot of us in the country think, all right, well, these guys are tough. We have to show that we're tough, and we have to stand up to these guys and not give them an inch. Why is that not the proper approach? And if that's not the proper approach, what is the proper approach with a country like North Korea?
Yeah, without question, it's the wrong approach, and you don't have to look very far than the history books going all the way back to, really, to the 96 time when Clinton was trying to do a lot of his, you know, nuclear deals with North Korea, but especially since I believe it's 2006 is when they tested their first nuclear weapon. All of these processes by demanding complete denuclearization up front, all it does is push them further in the direction of doing it, because they're not going to get rid of it. I mean, look, we just got to accept it. They have nuclear weapons, and there is no way on earth that they're just going to give them up for nothing in return but some promises. The whole reason they have them is to deter the United States from doing to them what we've done to Saddam Hussein, what we did to Muammar Gaddafi and ad infinitum. Anyone that doesn't have nuclear weapons is at risk from the United States, but nuclear powers, they don't have it. And that's why he has it. So there's no way he's going to get rid of it. So let's don't put that as the number one item. Let's put that way at the end of the aspirational later. But there is very much room for improving the situation right now, lowering the tensions, it fostering, to answer your second part of your question, what will work is let's take a step-by-step approach and let's take some cues from the South Korean president, Moon Jae-in, who has more at stake than anybody for this thing to work out well. He's got some good ideas about how to, you know, make the economic cooperation between the two countries better, doing things on some of the cultural aspects and visits, et cetera, everything to lower tension so that they don't want to move in. Now, they will have some agreement to people I know who have been part of some of these negotiations behind the scenes that they would be willing to give up some significant things in exchange for something significant, like they would dismantle some real important nuclear facilities, or they would put in some nuclear freezes or some missile freezes in exchange for targeted, temporary, and reversible sanctions relief. See, that's the other thing I just got to tell you, is one of the worst tools that we use in foreign policy because it's the most failed thing that we do, which is we just put sanctions on people. We don't ever pull sanctions off. And the whole value of sanctions is to get the target country to do something that we want or to have behavior that we like. And if you don't ever give them the opportunity to remove those sanctions, then they have no incentive to do anything but just keep on going in the wrong direction. And we've got to have the ability and the courage to have limited targeted sanctions relief in order to get something concrete in return. And I'd like to see the Biden administration go down that path.
Is it still wise, and if people just tuning in, we're talking with retired Army Lieutenant Colonel. Lieutenant Colonel, or were you a full colonel, sir?
Yes, Lieutenant Colonel.
Retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis. He is a senior fellow for Defense Priorities, a terrific think tank. Is it still wise for us to have tens of thousands of American troops on the demilitarized zone on the border between North and South Korea?
You know, they've moved most of those off. When I was first stationed there in the late 90s, there was quite a large number of combat troops up in that area, which I spent quite a bit of time going on reconnaissance and other things through that whole area. And most of those have been returned and moved further back south, back into Seoul, 8th Army headquarters and Osan Air Base, et cetera, much further back. But, you know, I think that there is going to come to a point, and we're probably getting closer to it, when it is time to revisit, do we need this many troops there? Is it appropriate to have this many troops there? Because the South Korean military has been, you know, I mean, they were pretty good in the 90s when I was there, and they're 10 times better than that now. And of course, you know, South Korea has the world's 11th largest economy, so they can afford to pay for their own defense, and they can do a lot more. And I think they want to do a lot more. I think they want command of the Combined Forces Command, the CFC, I believe it's called, the UN command that's still all the way back from the Korean War still in place, but it's always been an American commander. And I think it's time to say, hey, let's let the Koreans be responsible for their own and let's take a step back and let them take a step forward. I think that's appropriate and it's good for them to take a bigger step in their own defense.
All right. Let's look at another Asian hotspot, and that's Taiwan. Some members of Congress, delegation of United States lawmakers, made a trip to Taiwan on Tuesday, sparking immediate condemnation from China. The Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, says that the U.S. and our allies would take action if Taiwan were attacked. Even Europe is saying that they're very displeased with China's increasing belligerence towards Taiwan, which, of course, they view as actually part of China. What's your view on the nature of the Taiwan situation now, and what's your suggestion in terms of how the United States should handle it going forward?
Yeah, this is the biggest potential to drag the United States into a catastrophic war that we face right now. The situation between Russia and the Ukraine is a bit of a distant second, but this is overwhelmingly number one that could get us into real trouble. Because the issue of Taiwan with mainland China is an enormous emotional issue, very much. It's probably analogous to our situation with Cuba. And like during the Cuban Missile Crisis, you can think of how awful we were thinking about even the possibility of having a Soviet military on Cuba and how we were literally willing to go to war and possibly nuclear war. It's even more important and more emotional to China in the Taiwan situation. for them. And look, there is no security issues involved in the United States at all. We don't want the democratic, you know, a country of Taiwan to be absorbed by China. We certainly don't want that. And we would work, you know, diplomatically and economically to keep that from happening. But we absolutely cannot, I cannot stress this enough, go to war with China over the issue of Taiwan for the main reason that we can't do it. Look, China is 100 miles off the coast of Taiwan. It's 6,000 miles off the west coast of the United States. All of our military capacity, if you're comparing the two countries together, we're overwhelmingly superior in virtually every category. But we're not talking about global capacity. We're talking about who has tactical, conventional, and nuclear capacity in the Taiwan Straits area, and they have the overwhelming advantage. We would almost certainly lose a war if we started one. And just imagine how foolish it would be to go and fight something that we can't win, and Taiwan would still be lost, except for now that we've maybe got an aircraft carrier on the bottom of the East China Sea, hundreds possibly of aircraft being shot down, thousands of American troops died for nothing, in a situation that we didn't even have our own security at risk. That is why I'm so outspoken that we have to be very, very careful here, that we don't start writing checks that we can't cash and making promises to Taiwan, because it sounds tough to do, but it could absolutely just wreck our security across the globe if we were to do something foolish like that.
Let me end with this, sir, and I could talk with you all day, believe me, about all the national security threats the country is facing. But I caught a column that you wrote, I guess a couple of weeks ago now, in Responsible Statecraft. People could check it out at responsiblestatecraft.org, where the headline is, "Our troops are targets in Syria. Why is Biden keeping them there?" I think that question is really one of the most important questions facing American defense policy today. Joe Biden, who took a lot of pride in ending the forever war in Afghanistan, seems to have no problem keeping troops in Syria even after a U.S. outpost is struck again, this time by Iranian-backed militias. Why are we keeping troops in Syria? And why, in your view, is it time to end that policy?
Yeah, you know, I lump the troops in Iraq and the troops in Syria together, and they all need to come out, because right now the only thing they do, the only service that they provide, is to make it easy by putting a target on their back for some of these Iranian militia or just any number of other rebel groups out there that don't like the United States. It gives them the ability to target our people. Now, there's been, I think, upwards of 60 total missile strikes this calendar year against our troops in both places, and it's just been miraculous that so far none of them have been killed. But, you know, let one of those missiles land on target, and now all of a sudden Biden's got dead Americans in her hand, and of course no American president's going to be able to not respond if there's American military casualties. So now then you've got the possibility of accelerating the conflict, maybe even striking into Iran if it's determined that they had anything to do with it. And now then you're potentially risking a war and expanding the military footprint. Look, if our troops aren't doing anything that's going to keep Americans safe, and none of those guys are, let me categorically say that, they need to be withdrawn. Don't put American service members' lives at risk when our security even is a threat and they don't help our country. We need to pull them back right now before one more American gets killed.
Colonel Davis, thank you so much for the time this morning. I hope everybody checks out your book, 11th Hour in 2020 America. Even though the 2020 election is over and the year 2020 is over, the book is still more important now than ever. Appreciate the time this morning, sir.
Always my pleasure, Frank. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. If you want to comment on any portion of my discussion with Colonel Daniel Davis, please give me a call, 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-9222. You know what the headline at the Drudge Report is right now? Consumer prices surge, 30-year high. But you don't need me to tell you that. You don't need Drudge to tell you that. Go to the grocery store, go to the gas station, go to any place that sells anything, and you see that inflation is taking a giant bite out of your wallet. So what can you do about it? Gold, silver, precious metals, that is a hedge against inflation. The more inflation goes up, the more gold goes up. You know, I got a statement on my Roth IRA yesterday, and I don't have a lot of money in there, but, you know, I put $100 a month away in there and then make certain allocations. I strongly thought about, because I saw this inflation report yesterday, I strongly thought about taking every dollar that I have currently in my Roth IRA and putting it all in gold. Because if you look at what gold has done under the last 6 months, the last year, and what the dollar is doing, I mean, to me, it's a pretty clear-cut case. And I have a feeling that because of the rampant inflation in our economy, pretty soon this stock market bubble, which is being blown up with quantitative easing and the like, I have a feeling this stock market bubble is going to burst. If you're concerned about inflation, if you're concerned about the potential of a stock market bubble bursting, then you need to think about converting your retirement accounts to gold. If you do it with Legacy Precious Metals. These guys are experts. These guys are experienced. And in fact, I want to invite the head of Legacy Precious Metals on again, because I think some of you actually may have a lot of questions about this kind of thing, and I'm certainly not qualified to answer them, but he is. So gold should be a part of every wise investor's portfolio. It's certainly a part of mine. Legacy is the company that you can trust because they give you unbiased counsel based on your individual situation. Contact Legacy Precious Metals today. Call 866-932-0635. That's 866-932-0635. Or visit LegacyPMInvestments.com. That's LegacyPMInvestments.com.
77 WABC, where the action is.
The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano. 77 WABC.
Tie a Yellow Ribbon by the great Tony Orlando and Dawn. You know, Tony Orlando, aside from doing a great radio show, and aside from being a great talent, is really just a heck of a nice guy. And he's going to be performing in New York on Monday. And I'm actually, I was going to try and go see him, but, you know, my wife is not really in the mood to go out much these days. So, I mean, I'm not going to go out more than once, you know, next week without her. And I already have plans one night. So, I don't really feel like going because I want to be home. God forbid, but in case she has the baby or whatever the case may be. So, I do think I'm going to invite Tony Orlando to join me in studio. So he's performing Monday night in Manhattan. So I'm going to try and see if he's up for coming and join me live maybe Tuesday morning. So we'll see. I just sent him a note literally just now. So we'll see if he's up for joining me. He's raised more money for veterans than maybe almost anybody. That song has raised about $250 million for veterans over the years. Imagine. 800-848-9222. Steve is in Manhattan. Hello, Steve.
Do you want me to do the news or comment on the China military? And Kyle, I'll do those two. First of all, the Chinese military, folks, you have to realize, has been rebuilt by U.S. companies going in there for the last 30 years and European countries. The average yearly income of Chinese people 30 years ago was $300. Figure that out. Now, Kyle Rittenhouse, it's simple. Everything is on video. I watched everything. It's clear. This kid acted in self-defense. He's like a political prisoner over there. And if you watch everything, the testimony of the kid who got shot in the arm, I call him the one-armed bandit, actually said he pointed his gun at Kyle just before he got shot. That's self-defense. Now, you got to realize, too, he couldn't say anything else because the video backs up Kyle Rittenhouse. And the thing is, you remember Bernie Goetz? Bernie Goetz was on a number two train. Shooting took place in Manhattan over 35 years ago. If that train was in the Bronx at the time, old Bernie would have been doing 25 years to life. It depends on the jury. Like you heard the woman a few calls ago, she would have convicted Kyle Rittenhouse. Folks, he's a political prisoner. No intent to kill anybody. He was there to help out. It was called
Hey, thank you, Steve. Hey, I know Bernie Goetz is listening right now. right now. He listens every day. Bernie, since your name was invoked, if you want to call in and comment on this case or anything else, you're welcome to. 800-848-WABC. Until next hour, help control the pet population. Make sure you get your dog or cat spayed or neutered.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. I am very pleased to be here as the first, well, one of the first shows to broadcast on Veterans Day. We have a full day of veterans programming for you. I think John Catsimatidis is actually doing his show from the Intrepid, which is pretty neat. I think Bernie and Sid may be there as well. I don't know if they're going to be there for their show or if they're going there later. We're going to have a special radio, not radio, but a special veterans roundtable around 11 o'clock this morning. Rita Cosby's participating in it. I think our owner, John Catsimatidis, is participating in it. And that's going to be right out of Stage 77. You can watch that by going to WABCradio.tv. And, you know, one of the items that you hear so much about, and it happens to be true, is the problem with veterans suicide. And one group that I've become pretty close with over the years, and I highlighted them last year as well, and I'll mention them a couple of times throughout the day, is the Gold Shield. And the Gold Shield is a terrific entity which is designed to put an end to the epidemic of veteran suicide. You might have heard Tony LoBianco in his interview with John Catsimatidis in the 5 p.m. show yesterday mention the Gold Shield. If you want to learn more about them and learn more about what they do and help spread the word about them, I'd really encourage you to go to thesimpletruth.us, thesimpletruth.us. And they're a great group. And it's a simple concept, and it's something that I'm a big believer in, and I know Tony LoBianco is. So if you're interested in doing what you can to put an end to the epidemic of veteran suicide, then I would encourage you to, you know, to go there, thesimpletruth.us. And, you know, I really, really am a big supporter of these guys. Now, I mentioned yesterday that MSNBC's Brian Williams, the veteran anchor who was once suspended for falsifying stories earlier in his career, announced Tuesday that he would be stepping down from his program and depart NBC at the end of the year after nearly three decades with the network. And the president of MSNBC put out a memo Tuesday night saying, as an award-winning journalist and anchor at MSNBC and NBC News, Brian Williams has informed us he would like to take the coming months to spend time with his family. He will be signing off from the 11th hour at the end of the year. Now, I don't routinely watch Brian Williams, but I really don't watch any cable news. I used to say that only two shows on cable news that I would watch were Tucker Carlson on Fox News and Michael Smirkanish on CNN, because those were the only shows that I found to be a little different. Although sometimes I hear this fellow, as I'm driving in on Sunday night, the host of The Next Revolution, Steve Hilton, I think I would watch him if it was at a time that was convenient for me. I would watch him, I think. But other than that, I am totally disinterested in cable news. And really, I don't even watch Tucker anymore because I only have a couple hours at home before I leave every day. And my wife is not a big fan of that show. It's nothing against Tucker, I don't think. It's just, you know, she doesn't like that whole format and everything. But sometimes I put it on and she watches. And if we only have an hour together to watch television, to watch something that we're watching together, like The Sopranos or Cheers or whatever the case may be. But so I can't really critique the 11th hour with Brian Williams with any credibility. But it was interesting, the statement that Brian Williams put out. Following much reflection and after 28 years with the company, I have decided to leave NBC upon the completion of my current contract in December. I've been truly blessed. and I've been allowed to spend almost half of my life with one company. NBC is a part of me and always will be. As for his next steps, Williams revealed no immediate plans for a new spot behind the camera. Now, somebody who works here asked me yesterday, they said, if you were Brian Williams, would you leave? And I said to this person, I said, well, I mean, there's no way for me to answer that. Maybe he's just tired of working. Maybe, you know, maybe he's made a lot of money in his life and he doesn't need to work and he wants to kind of take it easy. Maybe work once a week on a blog or a podcast or a newsletter or do something else rather than go in every day because it is a grind. Also, I don't know what the situation was here, if they really were, if he was really leaving on his own, or if he was being shown the door. It's certainly very possible that as his contract was coming to an end, they offered him a new contract for less money, and he didn't want to take less money. Certainly possible for that amount of work. So I have no idea, and that's what I told this person that asked me. But what I said, and this person agreed with me, was that I don't think I would leave, because Brian Williams gets about 1 million viewers a night. And he's on every day, and he gets 1 million viewers a night. Now, if you're part of a successful show, TV, radio, varying other forms of media, and you get a really successful show where you can, one, make a lot of money, two, have a lot of people watch you, and three, actually have influence, the chances of that happening are, I mean, it's like winning the lottery. It's like winning the lottery. So my answer really would be, again, not knowing Brian Williams' financial situation, I would hang on to that show like grim death. I would never leave that show. I'm never planning on leaving this show. You're going to have to drag me kicking and screaming out of here. But I don't have 1 million people watching a day yet. So I look at all the other examples of people that chose to leave when they were doing very well, voluntarily. Jon Stewart, when he left The Daily Show, he really did leave voluntarily. And I know he's launching a new show now. I think the chances of him replicating that success that he had with The Daily Show, I think it's astronomically against it. And it has nothing to do with him or his talent. If you create a hit show, you really need a perfect set of circumstances. Everything has to break your way. You need not only a talented commentator or a talented host, but you need a very talented staff. You need luck. You need a station that supports you. You need all sorts of things. So to duplicate that multiple times, very difficult to do. Very difficult to do. Jack Parr left The Tonight Show voluntarily. Because he wanted to be on primetime once a week. Now, he did some interesting things in primetime, but that time that he spent in primetime is almost totally forgotten. Everybody talks about Jack Parr as, oh, that's the guy that hosted The Tonight Show before Johnny Carson. Jackie Martling, who's been a guest on this show, who I'm friendly with, his decision to leave The Howard Stern Show over a financial dispute, it's got to be one of the most short-sighted decisions in history. One of the biggest radio shows in history, one of the most successful ever, and you're going to leave to do what? No, it makes no sense. So I don't think that I would leave. Brian Williams, I'm watching him right now. He's on one of the monitors. I don't think that I would leave if I were Brian Williams, but again, who knows what's going on inside Brian Williams' head, what his finances are, or what's going on in his personal life. But the thing that he was able to do, which is make a comeback after being so wildly discredited when he ran with a series of misleading stories, including 6 years ago where he admitted to lying about coming under sniper fire while reporting in Iraq in 2003. Now, he was suspended for 6 months and demoted before getting this MSNBC show. The fact that he was able to come back after only a 6 month suspension, that's amazing. That's amazing. It reminds me in some ways, I don't want to spoil the film if you've never seen it, but there's a wonderful film called A Face in the Crowd with Andy Griffith. And a lot of people picture Andy Griffith as this friendly old sheriff in the town of Mayberry, or a country lawyer that always figures out a way to win a case in Matlock. This is a totally different type of role for Andy Griffith. It's a wonderful film. It's one of those films, every time I see that it's on, I have to watch it. Walter Matthau was in it. It's got a great cast. And so much of what happens in that film, including to that character, Lonesome Rhodes, it parallels what has happened to so many other media figures. Glenn Beck, perfect example. Glenn Beck was at the top of the heap at Fox News. Highest rated show on Fox News. What was making millions, was hosting these rallies that tens of thousands of people were coming to. The guy had real influence. He was driving the agenda. And then he stopped doing that, launched his own TV network. Last time I saw Glenn Beck anywhere, I think it was on the side of a milk carton. And again, I'm not being dismissive of anything Glenn Beck's doing, but it's just when you have a hit show, the chances of duplicating that are infinitesimally small. I really, Seinfeld, greatest sitcom of all time, four of the best comedic performers of all time. You saw Jason Alexander attempt to make several comebacks for episodic television. None of them took off. You saw Michael Richards try to make a comeback with episodic sitcom television. Didn't work. Julia Louis-Dreyfus did have some success. Not anywhere near the Seinfeld success, although Veep is wildly successful, won multiple Emmys. But that's very, very difficult. Friends, another show, wildly successful. They try to, the fellow that played Joey Tribbiani, he tried to launch his own show. Not nearly as successful. It doesn't work. You can't go home again. So if I was Brian Williams, I would be riding that gravy train as long as there's still mileage left in it. And, that's my take. 800-848-9222. That's why I always thought it was a mistake for Gene Shepard to leave radio when he did. And I've read a lot about Gene Shep. I never got to meet him, but I'm a fan of his. I still listen to his broadcasts that are memorialized on YouTube. And I know he probably made a lot of money from A Christmas Story, and I doubt he ever needed to work again. But for him to leave a show that was as successful as his was for only doing 45 minutes a day, not something I could ever bring myself to do. Again, 20, 30 years from now, maybe I'll be singing a different tune, but I doubt it. I doubt it. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Norman is in Brooklyn. Hello, Norman.
Hello, Frank. Happy Veterans Day, Frank.
Thank you. Likewise.
Thank you. Listen, I'm the son of two World War II veterans. My father was a Purple Heart recipient, served in Guadalcanal, and my mom was a German translator in the Woman Army Corps.
Oh, wow.
During World War II. Yeah. I was just wondering, Frank, I know that you attend rallies. I know that you attend Veterans Day rallies, Veterans Day parades. What do you suggest today?
Well, look, I know we're doing some stuff at the station, but I think today, and I meant to today. Yesterday, I had kind of a crazy day. I meant to reach out to the New York City Veterans Affairs Commissioner or somebody from the New York City Veterans Alliance, which I didn't get to do. But I think the parade itself is probably worth going to. It starts at 12:30, and this year they're not only honoring Veterans Day, but it's also the 20th anniversary of September 11th. So I suspect that there's going to be some special meeting, and that's going to be carried on Channel 7. So if people can't make it to Fifth Avenue, then I definitely encourage them to watch it. It starts at 25th and 5th, though. I mean, that's probably where I would go.
25th and 5th.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, Frank.
And it runs north along Fifth Avenue.
Awesome.
Yeah, thank you. That's a good question. I should have mentioned that earlier. And this year's Grand Marshal is the U.S. Air Force veteran and local hero, Kevin Carrick. So, that's a great thing. I should have mentioned that a couple of times. So they're going to go from 25th and 5th at least to 40th and 5th. So we'll see. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Hey, coming up, we're going to talk with another terrific veteran, Kevin Randall. Kevin Randall served in Vietnam and is a retired Army lieutenant colonel. He also happens to be one of the most prominent ufologists in the whole country. So I really have a lot of questions for him about Roswell and where we're going with respect to the military. And then I'm very excited about talking with Frank Romeo. Frank Romeo is amazing. He is in the midst of a lengthy... He made a 750-mile walk to bring attention to PTSD. 750 miles. And he's had PTSD for 50 years. He's been advocating for PTSD awareness for 30 years. And he sees a big disconnect between the younger generation's understanding of the idea of war and the actual reality of war. So we're going to get into that with him in a big way coming up at 3:30. And then we'll talk with Kieran Lawler, a Marine veteran of the Iraq War, coming up at 4:30. 800-848-9222. Andy is on Staten Island. Hello, Andy.
Hey, Frank. Happy Veterans Day.
Thank you. Likewise.
Yes, I think it's right that you worry about where we put our commas and our colons.
Yes, that's right. You got to make sure you're on point there, Andy.
Yeah. Well, you know, my dad was like from that greatest generation, so I'm the type, you know, I always salute veterans. You know, I love them.
Wonderful. Well, I think that's great. My grandfather was a Purple Heart recipient in World War II, and my great uncle, who died recently, was actually a triple war vet. He served in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. So, kudos to you for your father's service. What do you have on your mind this morning, though, Andy? Go ahead.
Frank, I have trouble with my computer and my phone lately, so I want to leave you my number with the call screener. You just call me direct. We got to play some ping pong.
Okay. Yeah, hey, sounds good to me.
Do you have the paddles, like the little soft rubber paddles?
I don't know. I have ping pong paddles. The same, I mean, well, they look like every other type of ping pong paddle that I've seen. Yeah, they're leather. They're not, it's not rough. The surface isn't rough.
Yeah, no, as long as they're not like those sandpaper ones.
No. They're smooth.
You get into playing like 2 or 3 feet away from the table, and you know,
I don't. I'm not that good of a player.
You'll get better.
Yeah, well, that's why I need to practice, Andy.
Well, talking about practice, we're going to record the song next week. If you have time, I'll pick you up. I'll drive you down. Whatever you want me to do.
Well, a lot kind of depends on my wife's situation, but sounds good to me. I'm definitely up for it.
I'm going to leave you my number.
All right, I'm going to put you on hold. Give Pete your number. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Kevin Randall joins me next. We're going to talk a little bit about Roswell and why the military might have covered up what happened at Roswell in 1947. Now, from what I am also told by Molly, we are actually on video right now at WABCradio.tv. Now, I'm afraid to look because I saw a video of myself last week, and to me, I looked like Jabba the Hutt, right? So I'm afraid to look at this video, but rumor has it we're live video streaming right now. So I was absolutely mortified at this weight that I gained, and I talked about it on the radio. And Mitch Suss, the founder of the Skinny Center in Westchester County, was listening, and he and his team of weight loss experts have done a great job with my colleague Greg Kelly. Greg looks great. Greg looks better now than ever, actually. And he said that if they did such a great job with Greg, they can do the same thing with me. So it's time for me to take that leap towards the Skinny Center. So after Thanksgiving, boom, that's what I'm doing. So I am very excited about this. They use lab testing and get to the roots of why you're not losing weight. Their program reveals genetic markers and isolates hormone imbalances and gets to the underlying cause. I was really inspired to see Greg, so I'm joining, and I hope you will too. The Skinny Center. Call them at 914-703-4811. That's 914-703-4811. Or you can go to theskinnycenter.com. That's theskinnycenter.com.
You're hearing things.
You're hearing things.
On 77 WABC.
The Other Side of Midnight presents The Midnight Files.
Midnight in the desert, shooting stars across the sky. This magical journey will take us on a ride, filled with the longing, searching for the truth. Will we make it to tomorrow? Will the sun shine on you?
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno here on 77 WABC. It is Veterans Day, so we are taking a look at the men and women who have worn the uniform of our armed forces. Now, one of the people that has proudly worn the uniform of the American military, in fact, he's a retired Army lieutenant colonel who's actually served in Vietnam as a helicopter pilot. He also happens to be one of the most prominent and respected ufologists in the entire country. He is the preeminent expert on the Roswell crash of 1947, which I think, whether you're a skeptic or a believer, that incident really represents a watershed moment in the history of the study of UFOs and extraterrestrials, at least in this country. He's the author of the book UFOs and the Deep State: A History of the Military and Shadow Government's War Against the Truth. Gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome back to the show Kevin Randall. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, glad to do it, but I'd like to point out two things for you. Number one is it's no longer the Armed Forces of the United States. We're now the Uniformed Services.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Yeah, that's what I thought, too.
That's my civilian showing.
No. I mean, it should be the Armed Forces. I don't know why they changed it to Uniformed Services. I noticed that a couple of years ago on my ID card. And the other thing is I also served in Iraq.
That's right. So you were you were in the Army and then you went into the Iowa National Guard and served there. Is that right?
I was on active duty in the Army. I went to Vietnam. I came home. I was going to go to college, went to college. I was in the Iowa National Guard for a while, took Air Force ROTC, was in the Air Force for a while, got out of the Air Force, and then joined the Iowa National Guard again, and we deployed to Iraq.
Wonderful. So we've got Army and Air Force covered. We've got 40% of the Pentagon represented just in this one phone call. Now, tell me about your experience in the military as it relates to UFOs. I know that you were always interested in UFOs from the time you were a teenager. You've written about it. We've spoken about it on this program. But you don't get the sense that the military is too welcoming towards being open about UFOs. So how did your experience in the military jive with your interest in what we used to call UFOs, what we now call UAPs?
No, that's what you call them. I call them UFOs. I actually call them flying saucers.
That's a whole other argument.
Actually, I had no trouble. And what's interesting, I've always had a top secret clearance. Well, I had a top secret clearance after I got in the Air Force, and the Army only had a secret clearance. The agent who did the background investigation on me happened to live across the street from my father. And after I got my clearance, I was talking to him, and he had bought a number of magazine articles that I'd written that were somewhat critical of the Air Force and their investigations. So when I showed up at Richard Gebauer Air Force Base, my escort officer, my host officer, we went to lunch, and he says, you know, I read this interesting article about UFOs. And I'm like, okay. And he was telling me about it. I said, you know, I think I wrote that article. And then he brought another one up, and I'd written that one as well.
You're kidding. He recommended two of your own articles to you?
Yes. Didn't realize it was me who had written them. It was just articles that he had read about UFOs. But I never had a problem. It never caused me any aggravation. The only thing that was ever said to me was when we deployed to Iraq, the battalion commander suggested that maybe I should not use my rank when writing about UFOs while serving
in Iraq. But I didn't have time to write about UFOs. I was busy doing other stuff. Since I've gotten back, it's been no problem. I've never had a problem. I've gotten the security clearances I've needed. I've gotten the promotions when they were supposed to come through. Actually, that the problem with the promotions didn't have anything to do with UFOs. So I've never really had any bad experiences being connected to UFOs. One of the sergeants said to me one day, something about that. And I said, well, he was talking about me being identified as a UFO guy. And I asked him, because he was really interested in NASCAR, I said, well, do you mind being identified as the NASCAR sergeant? And he said, oh, I see what you mean. So, I mean, that's the only thing that's ever come up.
I'm somewhat surprised to hear that, because I know you've written many books on UFOs in general and on Roswell specifically. And some of these books and some of your commentary, some of your articles over the years deal with cover-ups by the military and the deep state to keep the truth from being exposed. So I would think that there'd be some pushback, some hostility towards you from within the military, given the fact that in your side role as a commentator, you're somewhat critical of the military not telling the truth, essentially.
Yeah, I wondered about that myself, but I think it may be that the level at which I was serving, I was serving as a battalion intelligence officer in Iraq, for example, and I was a helicopter pilot, aircraft commander in Vietnam, at the lowest ranking officer there is, a ward officer. And so I think the problem may have been that I was not high ranking enough to be exposed to these problems or have those sorts of problems because of where I was serving and what I was doing.
Understood. If you're ever nominated for Secretary of Defense or Secretary of State, maybe that's where the pushback will come.
Well, it would have come, but now we see a kind of a shifting in the tone of things, which actually I think of what's going on as what we were doing in 1947 with the Pentagon being interested in what was going on, what was happening, how is it going to affect our military stratagem, how is it going to affect everything in the world. And we've kind of moved away from that. We were making fun of UFOs and all of that sort of thing. And then we get back to the tic-tac thing and the UAP and this idiotic report that came out in June that was basically a C-level high school report on UFOs, but the attitude seems to be changed from ridiculing this stuff to what's going on. The attitude originally was what's going on, then it became ridicule. Now it's changed back to what's going on. We've got to find out what's going
on. And I'm pleased to hear that, and we've been chronicling that on this program, and that's part of what I want to ask you about. Before we get into what's happening now, let's talk about what happened in 1947 at Roswell. Based on your substantial research and your substantial investigations, there's no doubt in your mind that what happened in New Mexico was the crash of an extraterrestrial craft, is there?
Well, yeah, there's always some doubt until we see the smoking gun, a term I hesitate to use given today's environment. But we have eliminated all the terrestrial explanations. There is no terrestrial explanation. The Air Force actually helped us out there when they did the report in the mid-1990s, and they looked at everything and it said, well, it wasn't an aircraft accident. It wasn't a mistake with an atomic bomb. It wasn't an experimental aircraft. It wasn't a rocket from White Sands. And the best they could come up with was Project Mogul. And you look at the Mogul diary kept by Albert Crary, who was the chief of Project Mogul in New Mexico, the guy who was responsible for what was going on there, telling us that the flight they've pinned this on, the Mogul flight they've pinned this on, never flew. It was canceled. So there is no terrestrial explanation. I would like to see something more. I've talked to people I find extremely credible. Bill Brazel, the son of the man who found it originally and who handled some of the debris himself. I look at Edwin Easley, who was the provost marshal at Roswell in 1947, and I asked him at one point, I said, are we following the right path? And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, we think it's extraterrestrial. He said, well, let me put it this way. It's not the wrong path. So we talked to the officers who were in charge in Roswell in 1947, with one exception. They were pretty much leaning toward the extraterrestrial, and I think the one guy who, Colonel Barrowclaw, I think his reason for saying, no, it never happened, it was just nonsense, was to keep people from bothering him with a lot of questions about what he had seen and what he had done. So I think that the explanation we're left with is extraterrestrial, but I would like to see the smoking gun. I would like to see proof of the bodies, proof of the craft, proof of the technology. I would like to see something that leads us to an off-world production. And we on the outside don't have that yet.
So what do we know, or what do we believe that we know about what happened at Roswell, based on the people that you've spoken to, based on your elimination of all the other potential explanations for what happened? What do you believe happened?
I think it was extraterrestrial. It's kind of like the old thing: what do we think, what do we know, and what can we prove? Well, I think we pretty well think it's a extraterrestrial. I think we know it's extraterrestrial, but we cannot prove it. So we're at that level. And some people, that would be sufficient for them to accept it completely, and other people have a higher bar set for the evidence, the level of evidence you want. I would like to see something that we can get us over that top bar and prove it. But we've talked to the people. We've seen the reaction of the military. We know that, for example, on July 8th, 1947, they were talking about the Roswell Army Airfield having captured a flying saucer in the Roswell region. The next day, it was General Ramey empties the Roswell saucer. But there was another story that was probably more important. And it was, I think it was Associated Press story that said the Army and Navy has moved today to stop stories of flying saucers whizzing through the atmosphere. And you have to ask yourself, why suddenly on July 9th did they care? Since Kendall Arnold had seen the object, the nine objects 2 weeks earlier, the newspapers had been filled with stories of UFOs or flying saucers and what was going on and who was seeing them and all of this stuff. Suddenly, on the 9th of July, they start suppressing the stories. And you have to ask, why? Why did they suddenly care? And the answer is obvious. They had one, and they didn't want our competitors in the world to know that we had it. Because if we could solve the mystery of this thing, we take a giant leap forward that they can't possibly take, because we have access to this technology. I don't think we've been able to solve it yet.
We're talking with retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Randall, author of many books on the subject of Roswell, many books dealing with exploring UFOs, including UFOs and the Deep State. You alluded to the report from the Director of National Intelligence, which was released as a result of a congressional mandate. There was not really anything in that report. Basically, they acknowledge that the military has seen a whole bunch of objects in the sky that they can't explain, and they said essentially, well, we can't explain them. Do you believe that the reason for the vagueness and lack of clarity in that report is the result of a lack of knowledge, or a lack of truthful disclosure by the intelligence community in the military?
Or incompetence. You forgot incompetence.
Well, I'll let you you term it how you'd like.
Well, I think when you look at it, it was something that was thrown together at the last minute. I think what happened was Congress charged the Director of National Intelligence to come up with this report in 180 days, and they blew it off. They figured nobody cares. It's not going to happen. We'll just ignore it. I kind of explore some of this in the Deep State on how you can keep the president from learning about these sorts of things. And I think they just didn't think it would happen. And suddenly there was all this news coverage about what's going to be in this report that's due out in a couple of weeks. And suddenly they've got to put something together. So they throw together what they have, which is why it was so incompetently handled. Then they said, well, in 90 days, we're going to have another report. 90 days have come and gone. And we have not had the other report. There's been nothing more about it. We had our big show on June 25th, which, by the way, is the anniversary of the Custer Massacre, another great military disaster. I think there's maybe some linkage there. But I just don't understand what's happened there with this report. I think what we overlooked was the Navy said, well, these are real cases, meaning they were made by our pilots. The videos were made by our pilots, but we don't know what's on these tapes or what's on this video. And I think, you know, that's an honest conclusion, but it really doesn't tell us anything. And they say, well, we've had 144 reports. And you think, how many sightings is that? Is there multiple reports from one sighting? Back in 1947, General Nathan Twining issued a letter which said basically, what we're talking about is something that is not illusionary or fictitious, but something real, and we need to investigate it. We need to create a program to investigate this, which they did, and eventually I think the chief of staff of the Air Force, General Vandenberg, didn't like the direction things were going, and everybody who was involved in Project Sign, which was the investigation that was created, pretty much lost their jobs, and everybody else understood what the general wanted, so they began just doing the paperwork and that sort of thing, but not doing any real investigations. Fast forward today, we've got Twining 2.0, which is basically the same thing. Well, we've got the Congress saying you've got to investigate this, and here's what we're going to do, and they issue their report, and nothing has changed. We've 75 years down the road, and nothing has changed.
You mentioned keeping presidents in the dark. How in the dark do you think most presidents happen to be? Let's take the four most recent presidents, for instance, Biden, Trump, Obama, and Bush. What do you believe those presidents knew or know about the nature of extraterrestrials and UFOs and the military's interaction with them?
I don't think they know much of anything. I think that the presidents are told what they need to know to operate on a day-to-day basis. Best example I can think of, there was a fellow named Morris Childs. He was a rabid communist in the 1930s. He changed his mind, but he was the head of the American Communist Party. He had inns in Moscow. He would go to Russia periodically to confer with the Russians. He was a spy for the FBI. The presidents didn't know about this. In fact, the whole operation was run out of the New York office. There's a book called Operation Solo, a book about him after he retired and after he died, so there would be no retribution, about his operations and what he was able to bring back in the way of intelligence work. But the point is, they didn't tell the presidents what was going on. The only president I know they told for certain was Gerald Ford. And the reason they told Ford what was happening was he had a meeting scheduled with the Soviets. He was worried about this and how he would interact with them. And they brought him into this and let him know that here is what we've been doing. But there was no need for him to know about that up to that point. And I think that's where we are with the UFOs. There's nothing that the president can do. There is nothing that he needs to know. He needs to operate on the day-to-day basis. If something happened, he would be, of course, what they call read into it. But I don't think they've done that at all. I think the presidents would ask questions. Jimmy Carter, and I discussed this in UFOs and the Deep State, how did they keep Jimmy Carter from learning this? Because that was one of the things he was going to do. And we look at that and we discover what happened when Carter sat down with George H.W. Bush, who was director of Central Intelligence at the time. And they're talking about UFOs. And Bush says to Carter, I would like to remain as the director of Central Intelligence. And Carter says, I'm sorry, I've got my own guy coming in. And he says, let's talk about UFOs. And Bush says, you're not cleared to hear it. He says, you're not the president yet. You're not cleared to hear it. Work it through your own way. But what we've got is the director of Central Intelligence telling the president-elect, I'm not going to tell you any of this stuff. And I think what happens, and then Carter comes into office, and he asked the questions, and the people in the intelligence committee said, we need to gather information. This is information that's scattered around in various intelligence functions and various intelligence agencies. Let us gather a report for you, a comprehensive report to tell you what's going on. And the report never gets written. And that's, I think, what happened with the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence. I think that he thought that he would pull that stunt and realized that with the news media asking all sorts of questions and being very interested in this sort of thing, that he had to come up with some kind of report. And he signed a couple of guys to make a quick survey of what they had at the Pentagon. And that's why we got this report that told us virtually nothing. But it stalled everybody, and everybody's happy. And now we're past the 90 days for the next report, and nobody's talking about it.
In terms of the deep state, and these deep state cover-ups of UFO incidents. How does a deep state cover-up work? Let's say there's video that becomes publicly available, which seems to be more and more common these days. You alluded to the Tic Tac videos, but we've now seen flying objects off the coast of California. We've seen, you know, glowing pyramids. We've seen multiple credible reports, both on radar and through all sorts of other cameras and all sorts of things like that, that seem to indicate there's something out there. How does the deep state cover this stuff up?
Because they throw mud at the wall to see what sticks. Well, there's a video on YouTube where a guy, I think, used a night vision device and hooked it to his camera phone, and he got an image that looks an awful lot like one of the glowing pyramid-shaped object that the Navy was talking about. So now you've created some doubt about it being some kind of a technological glitch in the equipment as opposed to something real outside the aircraft or outside the cockpit. And I think that's what they've been doing all along. There was marvelous movie footage taken in the 1950s of UFOs, one in Montana, one in Utah. And what they've been able to do is, well, the Utah thing was birds. It was seagulls seen at the extreme range of vision, ignoring the testimony of the Navy warrant officer who took the footage, who was that was his job in the Navy, was the film stuff, and he used a 16-millimeter camera to film these objects hovering over Tremonton, Utah. But they said, well, it looks like seagulls. That's what it is. It's birds. We're done. And I think that's what they've been doing all along, is they come up with an explanation. And it doesn't have to be a very credible explanation, just one that sounds good. The Lubbock lights, they decided those were birds in formation, except there's no birds flying in formations that glow in the dark.
Kevin, why do they cover it up? I can understand the situation in 1947 when you look at the context of the Cold War and things of that nature. Why do they cover it up these days? It seems like there's such an appetite among the public for wanting to learn more about what's out there, about what UFOs are doing, about extraterrestrials in general. Even yesterday, in all the coverage of this SpaceX launch, there was a lot of discussion about all sorts of Star Trek allusions and all sorts of discussion of aliens. It seems like the public is really ready. Why does the deep state and the military think that it's still wise to engage in sort of a cover-up?
Retention of power.
Simple as that.
Yes, and well, I go into greater depth in the book, of course, but what we've learned through our own history is when a technologically superior civilization comes in contact with a technologically inferior civilization, saying nothing about the morals of the civilizations or anything about their capabilities, but it's just the technology. When the two clash, the technologically inferior civilization ceases to exist. It's the mere introduction of the technology that radically alters that civilization. There's a marvelous example in anthropology in which the anthropologist, to induce people to talk to him when he was observing the tribe, would bribe them with steel axes. Well, there was an underpinning to that society in which if you needed an axe, you had to go to one of the headmen to talk to him, and he would loan you a stone axe. Well, a steel axe is far superior to a stone axe, and of course the headman has no way of making a steel axe. So he broke down one of the societal elements by inducing the people with the steel axes. It's just that. I think Sitting Bull, prior to the Custer Massacre, told the Lakota and the Cheyenne, don't take any spoils from the battlefield. And the reason he didn't want that done is because he knew they couldn't create the way to manufacture that. They couldn't. They had to come to the Europeans to gather, or the Americans to gather the ammunition they needed, because they couldn't make the ammunition. They didn't know how to make the ammunition. If they needed a weapon repaired, they couldn't repair it. They needed the American technology to keep that up. One of the other things is a clay pot for cooking is fine until you get a steel pot, which is much better. And I think Sitting Bull understood that by embracing that technology, the Lakota were sort of destroying their own civilization by the use of that technology. And he tried to prevent it by saying, don't take anything off the battlefield. Of course, the Indians, the Lakota took everything they get their hands on.
And one of the things that we see happening in Washington now, which I find pretty interesting, but maybe I'm being naive and hoping it will lead to something, and this is just going to be another DNI report all over again, is what we're seeing happen legislatively involving the National Defense Authorization Act. Apparently, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, one of my senators, is trying to insert a provision in there that would change how UFO reporting goes forward. Is this something that those of us who are advocates of greater disclosure should be optimistic about, or is this just a pipe dream?
I think it's a pipe dream, and we look at this is we've gone through this before. Gerald Ford, when he was a congressman, and there were a number of important sightings in his district in Michigan, and I covered those sightings in a book I did called The Best of Project Blue Book. But what he was inspired to do was to get congressional hearings, and that lasted for a day, day and a half, and then we go back to the way things were. So we have a lot of talk, and the deep state knows how to manipulate the situation. You have to remember that that people like your Hillebrand is an elected official who is not going to be there forever. The bureaucrats last forever. Mm-hmm. So the bureaucrats appointed by Bill Clinton are now showing up in the Biden administration. And so you have this continuity of their retaining their power, and they do that by burying the things that they think is going to lessen their power. It's all about the power and the money.
Sure.
That's what the deep state looks for, is the power and the money. And so the reason we don't know what's going on is because they fear the introduction of that technology. Admission that there's that technology out there is going to radically alter many, many things, simply because it tells us now that things that we held as being immutable truths are not, and that we can that interstellar flight is possible, and then we'll have people looking for that, and that will lessen their power. It's all about retaining power.
Well, finally, Colonel Randall, let me ask you about your podcast. I've become a big fan of your podcast. I listen to it through your blog. You've got some great guests on there. I enjoy the insights that you give on a wide variety of subjects, both what's happening now and some things that have happened over the course of the last 60, 70 years. How can folks listen to this? What's this podcast all about?
Well, it started out as a different perspective when I was going to look into a lot of different things like buried treasure stories. The Oak Island thing I did a lot of stuff on, and there were things on there. But it's just now been more narrowly focused on UFOs, and it looks at it from all points of view. I try to look at it. If the guest comes on, I try to ask insightful questions, as you do, to get their opinion as opposed to my opinion. But if they say something completely and totally ludicrous, I'm going to challenge them on it and see if we can't find the correct path through the truth of what's going on, as opposed to going off on bizarre tangents that don't lead us anywhere but divert us from actually finding out what's going on. So it's the blog is called A Different Perspective. It's at www.kevinrandall.blogspot.com. There's an embedded audio player to the side, and I think there's 180 hours of programming in that audio. If you just scroll down there, you can see where if there's a guest that you're interested in, you can listen to that. There's also a search engine. You can type in the name of somebody you're interested in, see if I've interviewed them, and it'll it'll provide you a link directly to that that particular interview.
Well, no, it's a lot of great stuff on there. Kevin Randall, that's R-A-N-D-L-E, kevinrandall.blogspot.com. Colonel, I appreciate the time this morning, and I'll look forward to our next conversation.
I'll look forward to it. It's always great to talk to you.
If you want to comment on any portion of our discussion, you're welcome to give me a call, 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight, straight ahead.
Wherever you go, go, go with 77 WABC. Go, go!
We are New York on New York's Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
The This is The Other Side of Midnight. All the songs, with the exception of the Tony Orlando song that I selected, have been selected by our associate producer, Molly Fichter, who is joining me here in studio. How are you doing, Molly?
I'm good. We were talking before. I said I was tired, but that's kind of unavoidable at this time of day.
That's just
time
true.
Of day.
The morning.
Yeah, I said day.
Yeah, right.
I didn't
say
night.
Okay.
Well, you were trying to catch me, but you
that's
didn't.
Right, that's right.
I caught you.
You're
checkmate, Frank.
That's right. You're hosting the show for the next 2 hours. Congratulations. All right. Tell me the methodology behind your music selections today.
I just didn't want it to be cliche.
Uh huh.
I did America, Neil Diamond. It gets less cliche as the night goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't picking, you know, the classic veteran song because we're limited to what we have in our library.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I was just going. So I mentioned before that both my dad and my brother's currently in the military.
What branch of the military is he in?
He's in the Air National Guard.
Oh,
and then my father is
in New Jersey?
In New Jersey, yes. Right. And my father was a naval officer. He was a JAG. That's Tom Cruise, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do Good Men.
Right.
Yeah, that's what my dad did.
That's pretty neat.
Actually, he did it in Cuba, too. But anyway, so my thought process there was like, what music? There's a very specific taste of music that comes from being in the military.
Gotcha.
And
that's what we're getting a sample of today?
There's a literal before and after of my brother's taste. So, because I got to see him growing up listening to...
Is he older or younger?
He's older. He's
older.
27.
And what's his name?
TJ.
TJ. All right.
Yeah, he goes by Tom, but...
Okay. Yeah, that's
I've always
name.
Known him as TJ. They're right. both named Tom.
And what's your dad? So. Oh, they're both named Tom. Okay.
The Tom Senior and Tom Junior.
Right,
but I really
nice.
Wanted to thank them today.
Very nice.
So I'm proud of everything they've done for other people, but I'm also proud of them for keeping it together for my family while doing such a hard job.
Well, that's very, very, very admirable. We thank them as well, and we want to wish them a happy Veterans Day.
And I also want to throw in my mom, because my mom did a really...
Can't do it.
No? No
nope.
moms?
Nope.
She wasn't in the military, but,
nope.
you know, I always
Tough.
Say... I always say
You
the
thank
families.
Her on Mother's Day. That's it.
But the families...
Right? All right, fine. You can go ahead and
think about
her.
The families.
Fair enough. All right, so she's been thanked. There you go. You know what your problem is, Molly? You're not drinking nearly enough Life Change tea. Now, I've noticed that, but I didn't want to say anything. It's a lot easier to make these kind of declarations on the air and really, really publicly hurt people's feelings. But Life Change tea is a life-changing product. What is it? It is a tea that serves as a daily detox, a gentle daily cleanse that tastes great. And works to get things moving. Well, it's no secret that stress can wreak havoc on our digestive system. And if that's you, if you're feeling stopped up and bloated, then you're going to want to try Life Change Tea. It's all natural. There's no chemicals, no preservatives, no GMOs. One package will last you an entire month. Life Change Tea is only available by logging on to the website getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. And if you use the promo code Frank when you order, you'll get to enjoy free shipping. So while you're there, you can check out all their other great products designed for your optimal health. So don't miss out. Life Change Tea at GetTheTea.com. Life Change Tea is the tea that makes you go. And as I mentioned, they've got vitamins on there. They've got things that are great for whatever ails you. Check it out. Life Change Tea. GetTheTea.com. Promo code Frank. Now, you want to find me on Twitter. You can do so at Frank Morano. Appreciate the follow there. Trey Peterson is now following me on Twitter. Welcome aboard, Trey Peterson. If you follow me on Twitter, I might give you a shout-out. And you can find me on Facebook as well, facebook.com/MoranoFan. That's facebook.com/MoranoFan. You follow me on Facebook, I might give you a shout-out as well. It is Veterans Day, so we are shouting out all the veterans, including Molly's brother and father. And coming up in a half hour, we're going to talk with Frank Romeo. You're not going to want to miss this. Your influence counts, so use it.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Good morrow, everybody. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. It is Veterans Day, and we're going to be talking in about a half hour with Frank Romeo, who's in West Virginia at the moment. He's in the midst of a 750-mile walk to raise awareness for veterans suffering from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. They say either 21 or 22 veterans a day kill themselves every single day. Now, you think about the number of people that have died from in the World Trade Center. That's about 3,000 people. You think of the number of people who died in the wars since the World Trade Center in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's about three times that. That's bad. Now, what would you say if I told you that the number of people that died by suicide in that same period was 10 times that? Now, that would be pretty alarming, right? That would be a big crisis. It's not the case. It's not 90,000. It's over 125,000. Think of that. That would be, I mean, that's a massacre. It's incredible. Now, I am happy to be a supporter of a group called the Gold Shield, which you can check out at thesimpletruth.us. That's thesimpletruth.us. Tony LoBianco mentioned them on the Cats Roundtable last night. They do some great work in terms of raising awareness of veteran suicide. And it's a great way to, I mean, it's the best way that I've seen to put an end to this. Basically, it tries to get private sector businesses to support charities that prevent veteran suicide. And if they do that, then they get to put a gold shield in their window. And this way we consumers know to look for the gold shield. So that's basically the concept. But go to the website. There's some videos and information on there, and you can learn more about it. That's thesimpletruth.us, thesimpletruth.us. Now, I was a graduate of New York University, and one of my teachers there was a professor named Bertel Ullman. Brilliant man, absolutely brilliant professor of politics and some other subjects. He also happened to be a communist. He's a communist. And it's not my calling him a name. This is what he calls himself. He's a Marxist. He's written extensively about Marxism. And I had him for a course called Socialist Theory. I think that was the course. And he said to me, not just me, but a whole big auditorium, a whole big class of 200 people. He said, I do view myself as objective. And he said, and I thought this was one of the better definitions of objectivity. He said, I view myself as objective primarily because I am disclosing to you my biases. And this way, you get to guard yourself against me to make sure I'm not going to secretly infiltrate your brain or something. And, you know, because the worst thing is when people pass themselves off as unbiased, whether they're professors or journalists or whomever, when in actuality they are biased. They're just pretending they're not biased. So he said, I disclose to you my biases, and I also don't penalize anyone for having views contrary to what I'm doing. And I mean, the grading was not too tough, as you might expect with a class taught by a Marxist. The grading was, I found, very fair. Thank goodness. And I mention that because I'm going to do the same thing, and I've always sought to do the same thing. In disclosing to you my opinions, my relationships, my friendships with certain people, and my, you know, whatever my sensibilities are on a given subject when we discuss it. Such is the case with James O'Keefe. Now, I have known James O'Keefe for about 10 years. James O'Keefe is a journalist. He's the founder of a group called Project Veritas. So, as we discuss this situation, I will admit to you that maybe my view of the situation is somewhat colored by the fact that I'm friendly with James O'Keefe. He mentioned me in the last two books of his. I'm not sure if I'm mentioned in the upcoming one. He didn't tell me that I was, so I'm assuming that I'm not. Been a regular guest of mine. I like him a great deal. That being said, I don't think my view of the situation would be changing much if I didn't know James O'Keefe. The FBI last week searched James O'Keefe's home as part of an inquiry into the theft of Ashley Biden. Authorities carried out a court-ordered search at the New York apartment of the Project Veritas founder 2 days after searching the homes of his associates. So on Saturday, they searched James O'Keefe's home. According to witnesses, according to people briefed on the matter, a day after O'Keefe acknowledged that the group was under investigation by the Justice Department in connection with a diary reported to have been stolen from Ashley Biden, President Biden's daughter. The FBI carried out this court-ordered search of James O'Keefe's apartment in Mamaroneck early Saturday morning after having searched the homes of two associates of Mr. O'Keefe on Thursday. FBI spokesperson said the agents had performed law enforcement activity at the building but would not discuss the investigation. O'Keefe did not immediately respond to a request for comment on Saturday, but in a video statement Friday, he said that his group had recently received a grand jury subpoena and acknowledged that Project Veritas had been involved in discussions with sources last year about the diary. Jimmy Maines, who lives next door to O'Keefe in an apartment complex in Mamaroneck, said a handful of FBI agents arrived early Saturday morning. They asked for James. I thought they were banging on my door. I opened the door. They told me to close the door, and I closed the door. That's exactly what happened. It was still dark. Brent Mickle, a teacher who lives across the hall from O'Keefe, said it was 6 a.m. when agents arrived. Mickle said the agents said something along the lines of, FBI warrant, open up. I ran to the door and looked out the peephole and clearly saw an FBI raid. You saw the jackets. Literally, it was just out of a movie. Mr. Maines and Mr. Nichols said the FBI agents were at the apartment for several hours. So in his video statement on Friday, O'Keefe offered a lengthy defense of his group's handling of the diary. And you could watch it. It's on Project Veritas's website. Saying that he and his colleagues had been operating as ethical journalists and had turned the diary over to law enforcement authorities last year and had sought to return it to a lawyer for Ms. Biden. I want to repeat that. They turned the diary over to law enforcement authorities and they sought to return it to a lawyer for Ms. Biden. Quote, and I'm sorry I didn't think to pull the audio, but I was kind of mixing and matching what we were going to talk about today. It appears the Southern District of New York now has journalists in their sights for the supposed crime of doing their jobs lawfully and honestly. Our efforts were the stuff of responsible, ethical journalism, and we are in no doubt that Project Veritas acted properly at each and every step. Now, Project Veritas did not publish Ms. Biden's diary, but dozens of handwritten pages from it were posted on a right-wing website last year, a week and a half before Election Day, at a time when President Trump was seeking to undermine President Biden's credibility by portraying his son Hunter as engaging in corrupt business dealings. Oh, I mean, how could anyone imagine that? The posting was largely ignored by other conservative outlets and the mainstream media. The website said it had obtained the diary from a whistleblower who worked for a media organization that refused to publish a story about it before the election. It claimed to know where the actual diary was located and that the whistleblower had an audio recording of Ms. Biden admitting it was hers. Ms. Biden is Joe Biden's youngest child. She's maintained a very low profile. She's not nearly as high profile as Hunter Biden, her half-brother. O'Keefe said in the video that tipsters had reached out to Project Veritas in 2020 to alert them to the existence of the diary, saying they had stayed in a room that Ms. Biden had recently been in. But O'Keefe said his group could not authenticate the diary and made an ethical decision not to publish it. He said that Project Veritas gave the diary to law enforcement and attempted to return it to a lawyer representing Ms. Biden, who he said refused to authenticate it. O'Keefe portrayed the investigation as politically motivated, questioning why the Department of Justice under Ms. Biden's father was pursuing the case. Now, that's where we are. Trevor Timm, who's the executive director of a group called Freedom of Press, he said yesterday, and I completely agree with him. I'm sorry, but this is worrying from a press freedom perspective. Unless and until the Department of Justice releases evidence, Project Veritas was directly involved in the theft, because if there is none, then the raids could very well be a violation of the Privacy Protection Act. I'll tell you, it looks to me very fishy. And we'll see. Look, if the Department has Department of Justice has evidence about this, that they were somehow involved in the theft of Ashley Biden's diary, then I'm sure they'll pursue charges. But I'll tell you what this looks like. This looks to me like they are raiding the homes and offices of conservative journalists that have an agenda which is at odds with the agenda of the Biden administration. And then they're going to use the auspices of a search warrant for this Ashley Biden diary to search for any sort of incriminating evidence. This is the oldest trick in the FBI and DOJ playbook. You get a warrant for something. Oh, I got a warrant for the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby. Let's go bust down doors and rifle through papers and search people's underwear. Oh, well, we didn't find the Lindbergh baby, but look what I found. Some cocaine. Oh, okay, well, we didn't find the cocaine. Look what we found. We found evidence of obstruction of justice on a parking ticket 5 years ago. Oh, well, we didn't find any evidence of anything, but when we questioned these people, they weren't entirely truthful. We got to nail them with a charge of lying to the FBI. This is the oldest trick in the DOJ playbook. And what they do is they try to trap you. They try to trap you either by making a statement that incriminates yourself, by you not having told a story that's at odds with another version of a story you told, or they will use a search warrant for one item and then use evidence obtained through that search warrant to charge you with a crime for something else. Because I agree with Trevor Tim here, and I find this very troubling from the press freedom perspective. They didn't publish this diary, and it looks to me like this is being used simply to give them a hard time and maybe nail them on something else. As far as the people that claim James O'Keefe is not a journalist, it doesn't matter. If you read the statute of the Privacy Protection Act, it doesn't matter. This is not a good precedent. So a government officer or provided, however, this is what the statute says, provided under searches and seizures by government officers and employees in connection with an investigation or prosecution of criminal offenses. Provided, however, that a government officer or employee may not search for or seize such materials under the provisions of this paragraph if the offense to which the materials relate consists of the receipt, possession, communication, or withholding of such materials or the information contained therein. I'll read that again. There is probable cause to believe this is the circumstances in which they can search for materials. If number one, there's probable cause to believe that the person possessing such materials has committed or is committing the criminal offense to which the materials relate, provided, however, that a government officer or employee may not search for or seize such materials under the provisions of this paragraph if the offense to which the materials relate consists of the receipt, possession, communication, or withholding of such materials or the information contained in them. So that is exactly what they're doing here. Let's say James O'Keefe did receive or possess this stolen diary. Let's say he did withhold that stolen diary. That, under the statute itself, that doesn't give them the right to raid his apartment. And I don't care whether you can't stand Project Veritas and James O'Keefe or whether you love them. This is absolutely outrageous from what it looks like. Again, maybe they'll come up with evidence that shows James O'Keefe and his cronies stealing this diary somewhere. I'm skeptical. I would really love to see some evidence on this soon. This is not good, no matter who it is. And again, if you're a liberal James O'Keefe hater, God bless you. This is America. You have every right to be. But if the Biden administration gets away with this, then when Trump is elected in 2024, or insert the name of whatever Republican president you don't like, that means they will be able to use this same precedent to raid the journalists that disagree with that administration. And that's not a kind of country I want to live in at all. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. The troubling aspect of this, just like the Kyle Rittenhouse situation, is I am troubled that there are so few people like Trevor Tim that are intellectually honest, irrespective of where the political chips fall. That's all I'm asking for, is a little objectivity. Call balls and strikes. If you're against an oppressive government that is wiretapping phones without permission, that is using lame evidence to get a search warrant and then never disclosing it, if you are against that sort of conduct when it's George Bush doing it, you got to be against it when Joe Biden's doing it. That's it. If you're against drone strikes killing innocent people when Barack Obama does it, you've got to be against it when Donald Trump does it. And principles have to count for something. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. I didn't have a chance to get into the Cuomo, this newly released Cuomo transcripts today, but today's already been kind of a heavy show with the Rittenhouse situation and everything, Brian Williams, and now this. So maybe we'll save the Cuomo transcripts for tomorrow. Meantime, consumer prices are at an all-time high. And Rudy Giuliani quoted Milton Friedman yesterday as saying, inflation is a tax without legislation. That's the way Milton Friedman quoted it. I'd never heard that quote, but I thought it was pretty brilliant. And the best way that you can fight against that is with gold. Gold, silver, and precious metals. So if you have a traditional retirement account, your money is being eaten away right under your nose. And if you have an existing retirement account, think about rolling it in to a gold or a silver IRA. And if you do that, you really should do it with legacy precious metals. Because the last time the stock market collapsed and Americans lost their retirement, those that were invested in gold saw big gains and avoided the financial carnage. That's why gold really should be a part of every wise investor's portfolio. Legacy is the company that you can trust because they give you unbiased counsel based on your individual situation. Contact Legacy Precious Metals today. Call 866-932-0635. That's 866-932-0635. Or you can visit LegacyPMInvestments.com. That's LegacyPMInvestments.com. I just visited their website, and I signed up to get their free gold guide. And I just got my gold investing guide on how to invest in gold and silver. And there's some great stuff here. And I am looking forward to learning more about that. So if you want to do what as I'm doing, go to LegacyPMInvestments.com. Hey, and you know, when you do request that free gold guide, I saw, and I didn't know this, otherwise I would have been telling you to do this the whole time. There's a drop-down menu on the side, and it says, how did you hear about us? You know, Larry Kudlow, this person, that person. One of the options is Frank Morano. I didn't know that. So what I would appreciate it is request this free gold guide. You lose nothing from it. And then just put that you heard about it from Frank Morano. This way, the good folks at Legacy know that you're responding to this radio program. So even if you hate gold and you love inflation, even if you hate gold and love inflation, go to LegacyPMInvestments.com anyway. Request the free gold guide and put that you heard it on Frank Morano's show. We're going to talk with Frank Romeo next, and we're going to get an idea of why he is in the midst of a 750-mile walk, and we're getting an idea of what we can do to stop or reduce PTSD among veterans. This is The Other Side of Midnight, straight ahead.
77 WABC, All-American.
The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano. 77 WABC.
Home was a swimming hole and a fishing pole and the feel of a muddy road between my toes. Home was a back porch swing where I would sit and Mom would sing Amazing Grace while she hung out the clothes.
This is a song called Home by Joe Diffie. I don't love this. This is a rare miss by Molly, but that's what we get for, you know, taking music recommendations from somebody that's been drinking at work, right? I'm just joking. We're not really taking that many of her music recommendations. All right. It is Veterans Day, and we have a full day worth of veterans programming here on 77 WABC. Our owner, John Catsimatidis, is going to be doing his show, the Cats at Night show, from the Intrepid. How cool is that? A lot of great veterans. It's going to be a veterans roundtable around 11 a.m. this morning, and you can actually watch that at wabcradio.tv. Rita Cosby's going to be participating, and a lot of other interesting people that are going to be participating. Now, one of the big problems that we've seen with veterans and or I should say our treatment of veterans, not only recently, but for maybe as long as the Republic has been around, has been post-traumatic stress disorder. Well, I'm very, very pleased to be joined by a gentleman who's not only been a warrior in the battlefield, but he's been a warrior in terms of fighting PTSD and PTSD-related disabilities, particularly those that veterans are suffering from. Want to welcome to the program Frank Romeo, who has been battling PTSD-related disabilities for 50 years. Frank, thanks so much for joining me this early in the morning.
Good morning, Frank. How are you? Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm doing well. So tell folks about your service. I know you served in the Vietnam War. You were decorated and recognized for your service. How long were you in Vietnam, and what branch of the military did you serve in?
I was in the Army, 68 through 70, fought in Vietnam during the Tet Offensive. I was critically wounded, and I suffered post-trauma. Of course, it wasn't post-trauma. It wasn't PTSD at the time. There was no such term. We really didn't have PTSD. People don't know it. We really didn't have PTSD until the 90s. And so, you know, for decades, veterans like myself were misdiagnosed with the same affliction. We were called anything from Vietnam War syndrome to shell shock to depressed. And so we were mistreated, which eventually, through the efforts of Vietnam veterans, evolved into what we know as PTSD today.
Well, I want to ask you about what you're doing today and what you've been doing. But first, shed some light on the current situation involving PTSD in our country. We've seen, not only here in New York, but around the country, a real problem with veteran homelessness. What percentage of veterans would you say are, what percentage of those that are homeless would you say are veterans, and how much of that is due to PTSD and or the alcohol and drug-related issues that come with something like PTSD?
We have approximately right now in this country 50,000 homeless veterans.
50,000. 50,000.
Correct. Wow. And the numbers are growing. Because of the current state of affairs, because of our economy, because of the way we ended in Afghanistan, we have a younger veteran population that's reeling, that's, you know, kind of trying to grasp their service and what they did in Afghanistan and the way we left, and they're questioning themselves. Compounded by the current affairs, and the pandemic, I mean, we've locked down homelessness, we've locked down mental health, we've locked down drug and alcohol abuse, we've locked down domestic violence. And so we have a population, not just a veteran, but we have a population that really is suffering from mental health. Compound that by the history of the veteran in this country, and we have a severe problem going on in our country. The suicide hotline is ringing.
We're talking with Frank Romeo. You can check out his website, walkwithfrank.org. He's been on a 30-year mission to combat PTSD among veterans specifically. And at 70 years old, Frank, you chose to shed light on this mission by walking 750 miles across New York State. How come? Where were you walking, and why did you choose this as the manner in which to get your word out?
Well, I've been teaching it for 30 years, and not to use a phrase of a one-man army, but literally I was. I would drive across the country. I would speak to anyone. I used veteran PTSD artwork as a vehicle to open a conversation. And I would travel across the country and talk to anyone who would listen, any veteran organization, any school district, any kind of organization that would let me set up and speak, many times sleeping in my van because I just didn't have the money to do it. I would do this for 30 years. Realizing everyone welcomed me, and it was a great program, and people were starting to listen to me, but I was limited. So I decided 2 years ago to walk across New York State. I walked from Buffalo in February when Niagara Falls was frozen. I walked from Buffalo to Long Island and Bayshore, and that's where I live, in Bayshore, out on the island. And to get attention, people started to pay attention to me, and people started to listen to me. And now my programs are used through in high schools throughout New York State, really around the country, about PTSD. I created the first PTSD mental health program curriculum in the country.
Wow. So what have you learned in terms of the best ways to treat PTSD, whether among veterans or anybody else? What strategies should people be looking for? What methods of treatment should people be on the lookout if either they themselves are suffering PTSD or if they might have a family member that's suffering with it?
Well, I believe PTSD is inherent in us. I don't believe in medicating it. I believe in embracing it and learning more about yourself. So I teach that one-on-one, talking to other veterans, and I learned to listen on the walk. I learned to listen. I can talk for hours, but I learned to keep quiet and listen, and let them tell their story. Let them expel the demons and listen to them. And I think we have to, in today's society, we're really grouped into different categories, and we've lost that ability to listen to each other. And I think that makes it so much harder for our veterans. They need to be heard. They need their voices heard. And what the film did, I made the film, was to give them a voice and allow them to have a voice and talk. So I personally was medicated for 2 decades. I was misdiagnosed in the beginning, and I was drugged for 2 decades. And I don't believe in that. I believe in one-on-one treatment. I believe in the sufferer has to learn to embrace their trauma. It's not going away. PTSD, to me, is inherited. It's a feeling we all have. We're all sufferers, and we're all survivors now. We've just all gone through a pandemic. And so we all are survivors of something, whether it be the death of a loved one or a car crash or a pandemic. We all are survivors. And with that, we have a responsibility to help those that are suffering.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, Frank. So is there any sort of difference in terms of the toll PTSD takes or the treatment for PTSD if, let's say, you're a combat veteran and you're returning home, or let's say you're in a car accident and you see a loved one die next to you in that car accident on the Jersey Turnpike? Is there any sort of difference in the PTSD based on the sort of experience that is causing the trauma?
There's a difference, of course, from where it comes from. My PTSD is war-based, is combat-based. But trauma is trauma, and people that have lived through our workers in a hospital, our essential workers in a hospital. I mean, think about being – the movie just screened in Elmhurst Hospital, which is one of the hardest hit hospitals in New York City during the pandemic, and I spoke to their staff about dealing with trauma. Trauma is trauma, and how we deal with it and how we learn about it and how we learn what it is and how we embrace it is how people are able to move forward when it happens to them. We're all sufferers of something. On my website, I did a podcast during the pandemic called the PTSD Pandemic.
I heard it. It's terrific. Really well done.
The crisis after the crisis. And so we're at that stage. We don't even know what's happening to us. When you're a combat soldier, when I came home, my body, my mind was changing. My physical appearance was changing, and I didn't know why. And I started to get these feelings and emotions, and I didn't understand it. I didn't know why. So education, and I believe in education, and that's what I've been doing for the last 30 years, is educating people about PTSD and what they can do to understand it and to embrace it. I don't believe in medicating it. It's a natural feeling. It's been with us since the beginning of time. You know, you think about your grandmother or someone, a loved one that died years ago, and you get teary-eyed and your heart starts to beat. And, you know, that's post-trauma, you know. And so why medicate that most wonderful feeling that we have? And if we look at it that way, that it's naturally inherent in us, it's a natural reaction, we can handle it better and we can understand it better. And so I don't believe in some of the medicating and some of the medical treatment that we have today. I believe we need to talk about it, get it out. And again, with the stigma surrounding mental health, I mean, we have to start treating mental health as we do physical health. You know, we have to talk about it out loud. It's stigma. So many people I met they would tell me their story, but they'd always start the story with, I never told anyone this before. Mm.
Talking with Frank Romeo, check out the website walkwithfrank.org. You can learn more about his program, which is called The Art of War. You can listen to the podcast, learn a little bit more about this documentary. Tell us about this documentary, Frank. So the documentary chronicles your 750-mile walk across New York State?
It is the story. It's called Walk with Frank. And it's the story of PTSD from its inception, from the Vietnam veteran. And it covers 50 years right up until the present diagnosis and treatment. And it talks about the PTSD through its stages. And it talks about it through the eyes and the voices of homeless veterans. So on my walk for 3.5 months, I lived in homeless shelters with our homeless. And I documented their stories. And I chronicle that, the walk. It's told through the walk, but it is the story of PTSD. And we flash back to the 60s. We flash back to other wars. I meet veterans, young veterans and old veterans, homeless. You know, why are they homeless? They weren't born homeless. They didn't strive to be homeless. They became homeless. And why is that? Why did they become homeless? And usually each one of these homeless that I lived with, there was some traumatic event in their life that triggered a spiral, a downward spiral, and something that triggered their lives falling apart. And we chronicle that in the film Walk with Frank. And I'm on tour with it now, and I'm in West Virginia right now, and I'm traveling with the film, and we're reaching out to our veteran community. With a message of hope and understanding and education and talking about your trauma. We all have it. The idea is to talk about it. Start that conversation.
So
as we say, I keep the conversation going.
Well, so what can people do if they are dealing with these PTSD issues? What's the best place for them to begin in terms of turning things around? Is it your program? Or do you have some other sort of step one that you'd recommend to people? What do people do?
Step one is taking that first step, what we call taking the first step, admitting you have an issue. whether it's big or small, whether it's sometimes or all the time, doesn't matter. And it's reaching out to someone to start a conversation, start talking about it, and one thing will lead to another. You have to take the first step. And many times that's the hardest problem, is taking that first step, especially in our veteran community. I mean, there are programs, every town in America has veteran programs. There's countless veteran programs, yet we still have rampant suicide. Why is that? Why is everything that our government doing and what NGOs are doing, why is it not working? Because we're looking at it in a different way. We wouldn't have 22 suicides a day in the veteran community if all these programs were working. So we have to try something different. And something different is education, starting at the beginning, starting to talk about it, starting to dissolve that stigma surrounding mental health by just verbalizing. When you say, I have a mental illness, I'm Frank Romeo, I have a mental illness, just by saying those words, we're attacking the stigma. And it's swept under the rug. We're afraid to talk about it.
You've mentioned suicide. You've mentioned suicide a couple of times. Tell me a little bit about the nexus between veteran suicide and PTSD. I know that's a problem that's gotten a lot of attention. A lot of people talk about it in the media. A lot of politicians talking about it when they're running for office. Have we made any progress on that front, even if it's small progress?
No, it's actually, with the pandemic, it's gotten worse. And so we have to approach it differently. We have to start breaking down the barriers. We have to start talking more about mental health. When putting PTSD aside, we have all kinds of mental health that we just don't talk about it. You know, whether it's in the family, you know, and the family unit is probably the best place to start talking. And people, you know, that wife or husband doesn't know what to say to their spouse that's a combat veteran that's home now. They don't know what to say when they're in the corner by themselves and the family doesn't talk about their issues. You know, we walk up to our veterans now and say, thank you for our service, which is all well and good. But how about continuing the conversation? Like, you know, like we say here in New York, how you doing? You know, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how's everything going? You know, continue that conversation instead of just walking away.
Absolutely.
And so we need to start an open conversation, a serious conversation about mental health. And we're not doing that yet. In this country.
God bless you for what you're doing, Frank. I want to wish you the best of luck with the documentary. I hope people check out the website, walkwithfrank.org. Walkwithfrank.org, and you could check out
walkwithfrankfilm.com,
and you could check out the podcast on there as well.
Yeah, you could see where we're screening right now. I'm in West Virginia. Tomorrow I'm in Maryland. I'm headed to Kentucky and North Carolina with the film, talking to our veteran population.
Frank, I appreciate you joining us this morning, and please continue to keep us posted on everything you're doing, and you're doing a great job here.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Frank Romeo, walkwithfrank.org. You want to comment on any portion of our conversation, you're welcome to give me a call. 1-800-848-WABC. It is Veterans Day. 1-800-848-9222. Every day should really be Veterans Day. I mean, if you think about, I was blown away by that number he mentioned, 50,000 homeless veterans in this country. I mean, if you look at a lot of the other people that we're taking care of, either the government's taking care of them or charities are taking care of them, you'd think that homeless veterans would be number one on the list of people to get help. But it doesn't seem like that's the case. All right. I want to talk to you a little bit about Life Change Tea. Life Change Tea is a great product from the good folks over at GetTheTea.com. It's a feel-good product. You will feel good if you take it. Drink two big glasses a day, and you will be quite regular. It is a gentle daily cleanse that tastes great, and it gets things moving. It is the tea that makes you go. No chemicals, no preservatives, no GMOs. It's all natural. It just keeps everything moving. It flushes your whole system out. It's all natural, as I said, and one package will last you an entire month. By the way, you know, I'd be curious if, for people that have tried this, I'd love for you to go to the Facebook group and chronicle your experiences with it, good, bad, whatever. If you go on Facebook to Marano Radio Fans and Haters, talk about your experiences, because I suspect that you'll help some other people decide whether or not they want to try it. I know our friend Kevin has done that by chronicling his experiences on it. Now, here's the neat thing. If you go to GetTheTea.com and you order some of this stuff and you use the promo code Frank, that's GetTheTea.com, promo code Frank, you're going to get free shipping. You won't just get free shipping on the tea. Any of the supplements that you buy through there, the supplements to help your heart, your energy levels, your immune system, your digestion, whatever you get, if you use the promo code Frank, you will get free shipping. So GetTheTea.com, promo code Frank. GetTheTea.com, promo code Frank. Don't miss out. Life Change Tea at GetTheTea.com. It is the tea that makes you go.
WABC. WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano. 77 WABC. This is the AC Report.
Well, they blew up the Chicken Man in Philly last night, and they blew up his house too. Down on the boardwalk, they're ready for a fight. Gonna see what them racket boys can do. Now there's trouble busting in from out of state, and the DA can't get no relief. Gonna be a rumble on the promenade, and the gambling commissioner's hanging on by the skin of his teeth. Everything dies, baby, that's a fact. But maybe everything that dies, someday he comes back. Put your makeup on, get your hair up pretty, and meet me tonight in Atlantic City.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. It is Thursday morning, so it's the time that we do the AC Report, a segment devoted to discussing and exploring all aspects of news regarding Atlantic City. So I thought what it might be fun to do, since we are primarily focused on Veterans Day today, is if you have questions about Atlantic City and you want to call in, now's the time to do it. We have 6 open lines. So if you have a question about anything related to Atlantic City, give me a call and I'll do my best to answer it. And if I can't answer it myself, we'll get you the answer from one of the Atlantic City experts that we have on from time to time. So you can give us a call, 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. I have an email here from Mary Ellen, and I don't know if Mary Ellen's listening now, but hopefully she is. I am going to respond to this after the show today as well. She sent this a couple of days ago, so I'm a little behind. She said, hi, Frank. Love your show. So happy for your success. I live on Staten Island and working, so I listen to the podcast, although some nights I stay up. Can you recommend a restaurant for lunch, American or Italian, in Atlantic City? I am going there on Saturday and would love a recommendation. Honestly, there are so many great restaurants in Atlantic City. And I know that may sound like a cop-out, but it's not. And I'm going to give you some specific places that you could try. I want to think first of what places are open for lunch. Now, American or Italian? In terms of Italian, I don't think you can go wrong with Tony Bologna's. Tony Bologna's is great. They say there's only two places that you should ever go for pizza in Atlantic City. One is Tony Bologna's, and the other is Tony's Baltimore Grill. They're both a little divey, but they're really, really both absolutely delicious. Angelo's Fairmount Tavern, I'm trying to think if they are open for lunch. No, they're not open for lunch. Angelo's is only open for dinner at 5 p.m., so that's a little bit of a bummer. That's a great Italian restaurant. That's one of my wife's favorites. Now, as I said the other day when somebody called in about this, my favorite Italian restaurant in Atlantic City, it doesn't open on Saturdays until 4 p.m., but it's Il Molino. Il Molino at the Hard Rock. It used to be at the Taj Mahal. It's delicious. I actually find the Il Molino at in Atlantic City better than the Atlantic City than the Il Molino in Manhattan. I know that's sacrilege to say for a New Yorker. That is my view. That is my view. By the way, since it is Veterans Day, if you're thinking of making a trip there today, there are all sorts of offers for veterans. Now, at the Caesars properties, which include Caesars Palace, Tropicana, and Harrah's, they are offering up to 35% off on hotel rooms today. They also have an exclusive loyalty card for military veterans. It's called the Salute Card, and that will give you complimentary valet parking all the time. This is not just for Veterans Day. It's all year round. Special restaurant pricing, pre-sale access for shows, casino gift shop discounts. The Borgata, they are offering up until November 14th. So if you're not going until this weekend, that's fine too. A 20% discount available for all food and beverage outlets, and a 30% discount at full-service spa and salon services. At Bally's AC, they are offering military personnel a 10% hotel discount and a 15% discount on food. Hard Rock, they offer a special card for veterans that's called the Wild Card Veterans Card. And you can get a free coffee at either Starbucks or Rocktane and a $20 resort credit. Ocean Casino Resort, they have a dedicated lounge for veterans and their spouses today at the Sky Cafe, which is a great place that I've hung out at from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. By the way, just to Mary Ellen's question about lunch, the Gilchrist, it's sort of a diner. That's a great place to go for lunch if you want something a little more casual. Rife is a place that I really like. On Tennessee Avenue, there's two great places right over there, right next to one another, that are great for lunch. One is called Rhythm and Spirits, and one is called the Tennessee Avenue Beer Hall. I go to both frequently. They're both great. And it's right up the block from the Irish Pub, which is also a great place. The food there at Irish Pub is just okay. It's good for a burger. It's good for a grilled cheese sandwich. Anything beyond that, I think, is not necessarily that great. Gaspar's Italian Bistro is in Little Egg Harbor. So I don't know if you want to make the trip there. Probably not. I'm not the biggest fan of Carmine's, but my grandmother used to love Carmine's. To me, Carmine's is good if you have a group of five or six and you want to go and enjoy family-style meal. Not for me. I never was fond of Carmine's, but my grandmother, that was the only place she would go for lunch. They're open for lunch on Saturdays. A place I do love at the Trop, Carmine's is at the Trop. A place I do love at the Trop, Chelsea 5 Gastro Pub. Phenomenal. For American, the Gordon Ramsay Pub and Grill at Caesars is great. McCormick and Schmick's Seafood is great at Harrah's, if you like seafood. And a place that I'm told is fun, if you have a child, the Rainforest Cafe is right on the boardwalk. That's cool. I've never been there, but I'm told it's great. And another place that I'm hesitant to recommend, but I've heard nothing but great things about it, is for lunch, not for dinner, is Water Dog in Atlantic City. So I've heard a lot about that. 800-848-WABC if you have questions. Let me say hello to my friend Gino in Brooklyn. Hello, Gino.
Hello, sir. As you know, or may not know, I just came back from the World Series of Poker. Got myself a little beating there. Some interesting stories, but we'll save those. One thing that I was very surprised to see, although not totally rocked, they are eliminating now the dealers at the craps table. I saw this for the first time now by replacing, by keeping a live craps, you know, the typical table, but they're putting 10 self-kiosk betting terminals around the table, and they're eliminating three of the four staffers there.
At which property?
Right. I saw them sneaking this in. The only place I saw it, and again, I play craps casually. I saw it at the Flamingo on the Strip. In Vegas, right, because I was there. But think about it. They are now eliminating there's the one box. You know, you have first base, second base, third base dealers, and croupiers, and the box, the guy that monitors the box. Now they just have the one guy with the stick, and he's got his own terminal to verify the bets next to him. He's doing two duties, and they've eliminated three per shift, three dealers. Multiply that times a full 24 hours.
I hate to hear that. And, you know, they did do away with one craps table at the Borgata, but they replaced it with electronic blackjack, which was really, I hate to lose a live craps table because of that. But, Gino, thank you. I'm sorry you lost the World Series of Poker, but I appreciate the fact that you're giving us a heads up on it.
You got it. Take care.
All right. Thank you, Gino. We'll squeeze in a few other people here. 800-848-WABC. Bosco is calling from Hershey, Pennsylvania. Hello, Bosco. That was George Costanza's.
20,000 liberals and radicals came dressed up as moderates and centrists in the greatest single
exhibition. Pat Buchanan
of
in 1992.
In American political history.
All right. Thank you, Bosco. 800-848-WABC. I don't know what to do with that one. 800-848-9222. In other news, the Atlantic City casinos were voted among the best restaurants, employees, and hotels in the United States. So for the second year in a row, Capriccio at the Resorts Casino Hotel was named the best casino restaurant in the country. So that is pretty interesting. Other restaurants that made the top 10 list that are there were Il Molino at the Hard Rock, which I've told you about. American Cut at the Ocean. Dolce Mare at the Ocean, both of which are great. Izakaya at the Borgata, which is great. None of those really do lunch, though. Those are all great dinner places. All right. 800-848-9222. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed thus far, coming up next hour, we'll do the $1,000 minute. We will give you an opportunity to win $1,000, and Assemblyman Kieran Lawler will be here as well. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Until next hour, always remember, your influence counts, so use it.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Everybody, this is The Other Side of Midnight. I am Frank Morano. You know, speaking of Atlantic City and gambling, I'll never forget a movie. I'm a Curb Your Enthusiasm fan. I'm a Seinfeld fan. And Larry David, the creator of both shows, the star of Curb, he made a film called Sour Grapes about 23 years ago. Maybe more, maybe 24 years ago. And it was a good movie. I liked it. It wasn't exactly a wild success, but I thought it was okay. I thought it was funny. It had its moments. Is it classic? No. But, you know, if you like Larry David's style of humor, I thought it was interesting. And it has some actors in it that I like. So the film deals, it's set in Atlantic City, at least a portion of it. And the film deals with two cousins who get into a dispute about how they're going to share a $400,000 jackpot. And it creates a lot of tension, as you might imagine, within the family. It creates a lot of turmoil. But it's fiction. Well, there is a story I heard about yesterday, which I cannot get out of my head. I just can't stop thinking about it. So a Texas woman was arrested for stealing a $1 million lottery ticket from her Long Island cousin, who gave it to her to cash so he could remain anonymous. Iris Amador Argueta, 32 years old, Houston, Texas, also forged lottery paperwork to lead her kin to believe that he had only won a small fraction of the large prize. That's what prosecutors in Nassau County are saying. The million-dollar malfeasance, as the New York Post termed it, began when the victim bought a New York State Lottery $5 Hold'em poker scratch-off. Now, I hope Gino's listening. He might have had better luck buying a scratch-off than trying his luck at the World Series of Poker. So he bought this scratch-off ticket at a 7-Eleven in Glen Cove, Long Island, last October. He scratched the ticket to reveal his seven-figure haul. So he then asked the cousin, Iris, to claim the prize for him in exchange for $50,000 to protect his identity. Now, that's a pretty sweet deal. You go to somebody you trust, your cousin, a family member. You say, hey, psst, do me a favor. Cash this in. I don't want my identity known. Because that's one of the rules with respect to the New York Lotto is your identity has to be known. And you don't have to just do it because we're family. I'm going to give you $50,000. So the suspect drove from Texas to New York to get the ticket, which she had to mail in because of COVID precautions. And weeks later, she presented her husband with the phony note from lottery officials and handed him $13,436 in cash, telling him the state took the rest in taxes. However, the state had already issued a press release championing this woman's million-dollar jackpot while noting she took a $537,440 lump sum payout. So then the victim hears about this. I mean, it's public that she got $537,000. So the victim confronts his cousin about this. So she threatens him with legal action. Now, Nassau County officials said they recovered more than half the stolen money from this woman's bank account. According to the acting DA, Joy Smith, of course, we know the new DA coming in, and we interviewed her right after her win. This defendant exploited her cousin's trust, allegedly lying and manipulating him with the aim of pocketing the lion's share of his million-dollar lottery ticket for herself. Now, I cannot imagine this, that a family member trusts you so much with $1 million, and they're even willing to be pretty generous with you and give you $50,000 for nothing, for saying you won the lottery. And you reward them with unvarnished avarice and greed. I mean, what a jerk. If Bob were still around, he would call Iris a grade A sicola. It got me thinking, because I haven't been able to stop thinking about this all day, because I have cousins that I trust. I mean, I would never not want my identity known. I mean, I understand why people don't want their identity known, but, you know, you play, you win, you gotta get known. I would never not want my identity known, but if I did, I have several cousins that I would trust with cashing this ticket in for me. My cousin Andrea, my cousin Natalie, my cousin Gina, my cousin Joanne. Well, maybe not my cousin Joanne, but everybody else. I would absolutely trust the rest of them. And I think that I don't even think they'd ask me for $50,000. I'm just kidding. I would trust Joanne as well. But if you knew Joanne, you'd get why I'd say that. So this is awful, but it got me thinking. Have you ever been ripped off by a family member in such a manner? Has a family member that you trusted, not talking about a friend, but a blood relative, first cousin, second cousin, first cousin once removed, brother, half-brother, mother, father, has a blood relative that you trusted ever betrayed your trust and ripped you off purely out of greed. These people didn't have, they had an amicable relationship. They had a good relationship, clearly. And yet she still ripped him off. I would never do, first of all, I would never do that to anybody, but I would especially never do it to a family member. Have you ever been ripped off by a family member? 800-848-WABC. It is Veterans Day. We have a full day of veterans programming. Bernie and Sid are at the Intrepid today. They're going to be broadcasting live from 6 to 10, and we're going to have Brian Kilmeade at 10, and then a special veterans roundtable in the 11 o'clock hour live from Stage 77. You can check it out at WABCradio.tv. It's going to be streamed on video as well. I think it's on the radio too, but I'm not entirely sure. And I think the Cats at Night show and Rudy Giuliani's program also live from the Intrepid today. So that's going to be interesting. 800-848-WABC. That's 800-848-9222. Gus is in Monmouth County. Hello, Gus.
Yes. Well, here I am. I've been on the phone listening because that's what I was told to do. And I've just been listening to your segment about, you know, the $1 million, the lottery ticket thing. And what you said several times that stuck in my mind as it relates to veterans and post-traumatic stress disorder, you said several times, betrayed your trust. You were talking about the, you know, your cousins and the lady who, you know, cashed the lottery ticket in. Betrayed your trust. You kept saying things stick in your mind. Well, betrayed your trust has been stuck in my mind for over 50 years trying to deal with the Veterans Administration and my health care. And I'm sure most veterans would say the same thing. Dealing with the VA is impossible.
Still, it hasn't gotten any better.
Frank, you have, I'm telling you, I have post-traumatic stress disorder, but what I call it myself is trust burnout. I have trust burnout. Now, this is very difficult for people who do not have this to understand because you can't see it. I'm certainly not minimizing the pain and suffering of anybody, veterans or non-veterans, who have incurred physical disabilities. To this day, over 50 years after the fact, I can remember vividly being after, by the way, my post-traumatic stress disorder was begun when I was in special forces, part of my medical team's job was to jump out of airplanes, and I had a parachute failure. My main chute. But this was very unusual because when we jumped, my main chute, the silk came out, but it malfunctioned. When you're falling at 120 feet per second, that's before the chute opens. Rarely, sometimes you're falling so fast that the silk of your chute twists around and fuses together so that it doesn't give you any.
Gus, I just want to get to some other people here as well. Just can you bring the story to a close?
Well, I'll do anything you know, I appreciate the fact that you're giving veterans a chance to be heard, because again, dealing with the VA is more of a problem than a help. Why we have to employ 350,000 people to help veterans when all they do is make more problems for veterans.
Well, you know,
let me do what you said. I'm going to try to bring it to a close. My post-traumatic stress disorder, in large extent, is manifested in grinding my teeth constantly at night. This creates a lot of dental work that has to be done, and I have a VA-approved local dentist who has been treating me for years for all the dental problems caused by grinding my teeth caused by post-traumatic stress disorder. He is currently owed $3,900 in dental work.
Wow.
And is so, I don't know if I can say pissed off, but that's what he is. He's so pissed off with the paperwork that he is inundated with to get his money that he's basically willing to continue to treat me for free.
Gus, I appreciate you sharing that, and I'm sorry you've had such a tough time. And it sounds like there's still a lot of work that needs to be done at the Department of Veterans, at the Veterans Administration. So, Department of Veterans Affairs, excuse me, that was the old name. So we're going to continue to follow that. But I am curious, in reading this story, about this woman who ripped off her cousin for $1 million, somebody that was related to her, somebody that trusted her, somebody that was going to pay her $50,000. If you've ever experienced anything like that, I can honestly say that I don't think anybody in my family would do that. 800-848, I mean, I guess you never know until they do it to you. 800-848-9222. Anna is in the Boogie Down Bronx. Hello, Anna.
Hi, Mr. Frank. This is Anna. Yes, I had a family member that he trusted his nephew with $8,000 that he won from the lotto, and his nephew took the money out, and then he got married with this lady, you know, that he didn't really know, and then all of a sudden they bought cocaine, and they were doing cocaine for like 3 or 4 days in a row. They went on a coke bench, and 3 days, whatever, on the fourth day, his nephew died.
Oh, no. I mean, that's a horrible story all the way around. But, Anna, how did the nephew get access to that $8,000? Did his uncle give it to him, or did he give him access to his bank account? How did he have access to that money?
His uncle gave it to him in trust that he would put it away for him.
I see. Oh, so he was giving it to him as a gift.
To hold.
Well, that's terrible.
His nephew had a bank account, and then his nephew took the money out and went on the coke bench and snorted up for like 3 or 4 days, and he didn't used to get high. He was a correction officer at Rockets Island, and he went on a coke bench, and since he wasn't coke, you know, he wasn't into coke, he died.
No, I've seen that with friends of mine, actually, although usually it tends to involve heroin rather than cocaine. But in terms of that story, so did the uncle not have a bank account? Is that why he was dependent upon the nephew?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
That is awful. That is awful. Anna, thank you for sharing that. I'm sorry your family member went through that. But that is totally separate from what we're talking about, either getting ripped off by family or veterans issues. That is a textbook story as to why we need to find a way to get bank accounts to the people that are unbanked in this country, because they end up getting ripped off exactly like that. That is exactly what happens. That is far from random. And I have been a big believer in returning to the practice of postal bank accounts. Allow people to go to the post office and open up a bank account. No fees, nothing.
You go to the post office. You can deposit your checks there. You can cash your checks there. And it's a bank account at the post office. We had it in this country until 1965. It should be brought back pronto. There are some people talking about this. And you know who's been a leader in this? And I got to give him credit. Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders has been talking about this for three decades, and he's 100% right. There ought to be postal bank accounts in every state in America. If you're unbanked, you should be able to go to the post office, deposit a check, deposit your lottery winnings, whatever, and maybe even take out a small loan. The postal service is struggling, and this is a great way for the post office to make a little bit of money and provide a vital service to people that are being screwed by the existing financial services system. I've done whole shows on postal banking accounts, and, you know, I try not to do them too often because it's a little in the weeds. But I am sick after hearing that story. 800-848-WABC. Glenn is calling from South Beach. Glenn, are you in South Beach, Florida, or in South Beach, Staten Island?
Sound Beach, S-O-U-N-D Beach.
Oh, Sound Beach. Got it. Okay. I'm right. Sorry. We got peated. All right. Go ahead, Glenn.
Okay. So in 2001, I got divorced from my ex-wife. I moved in with my parents and saved money to buy a house. And my credit was really bad at the time. So I put the house under my parents' name. And in 2013, my dad passed away.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, so am I. And what my mom did is she took the house, put it into a trust under her name, and tried evicting me from the house.
You didn't get along with your mother, I guess?
Right. So we had a falling out. So I sued her under what's known as a constructive trust, stating that the house was in her name only, but I paid all the bills and all the incidentals on the house. So that's what happened there. And I ended up selling with her, paying her some money and getting the house back.
All right. Well, so I guess it worked out well. That's got to be a stressful situation to have to sue your own mother, Glenn.
Yes, it was very stressful.
I can imagine. Well, did you and your mom ever reconcile?
No.
I'm sorry to hear that. I hope you are able to find a way to do that. I'm a big believer that no matter how badly your parents mistreat you, that you should try and find a way to have at least some relationship with your biological parents. One, because in case you ever need an organ, they really are going to be the first people that you go to, unless you have a twin or a whole sibling, maybe. Two, without them, as horrible as they might be, without both of your parents, you wouldn't exist. So I feel like you kind of owe them something. So I feel like they've earned the right to wrong you a little bit. Obviously, it's different if you've been abused, maybe. Even still, they're still your parents. You wouldn't exist without them. 800-848-9222. Donna is in Huntington. Hello, Donna.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well.
Actually, my situation is basically to be. I try to do it really quick. But my mother, my father passed away 16 years ago. My mother passed away April 2015. She trusted. I have two brothers. She trusted the older brother to be the executor, trustee, fiduciary, whatever. He had power of attorney. Him and my other brother and his real estate attorney got in cahoots, and they got a fraud. Basically, they took their inheritance. Like, the will was everything was supposed to be divided equally. He basically took, they both took their inheritance in cash and.
Well, who was the executor? Who was the executor of the estate?
My brother, who's like getting, ripping me off.
Oh,
my two brothers are in cahoots together, and they got, somehow he got a bogus appraisal, like a fraudulent appraisal of my parents' house, like 10 days before she passed away. And he used that saying, oh, the house is worth $1 million. I'm deducting your inheritance, which was $675,000. And you still owe us like $400,000. And I realized what he did. And, I tried to say, listen, let me just sell the house and give me, I'll take mine. Instead of doing that, he goes and forecloses on the bogus predatory loan he put on the house. And I had to sue him in civil court. I got an attorney, sued him. They dragged it on for years, refusing to settle with me, with giving me anything. And then I end up having this female judge not understand how he swindled me with the house, because he did appraisal fraud, basically. And, like, you know, with the house, she throws my case out.
Oh, no.
I have to appeal. Yeah. She made a totally bogus decision because she looked at it and she thinks I owe them money for 4 years. You know, I'm just,
you
made
know,
it look like I owe them $3,200 a month for the last 4 or 5 years because I owed, and because he jacked up the interest rate, put penalties, fees, everything on it. Yeah. So I appeal it. And then COVID happens. I end up going, I get a mediator like 3 days before COVID hit in New York. And they were saying, like, you know, how much was her inheritance to my attorney? Oh, we'll have to do our own independent appraisal on the house. 3 days later, COVID hits. They never do it. And then February of this year, they closed the case saying we're going to leave it with the lower court judge. So basically, my brothers are getting away with stealing the whole, my parents' whole entire house, which is basically my inheritance. I'm still there, but I'm going to have to sell it, and they're going to steal all the money.
Donna, that's just awful.
Yeah, it's insane. It is beyond awful because my attorney said I had to get a DA, a prosecutor, to file criminal fraud charges. And guess what? I'm unable to find anybody to help me. Nobody will help me.
Well, did you go to the DA's office?
I did, and they tell me, oh, well, you have to go to the police, which I did. I went to the police. I got a police report. The police don't even, they're not even doing what they're supposed to do. So the DA doesn't do anything because the police haven't submitted anything on my case to them.
Well, I, you know, unfortunately, everything I've heard about Suffolk County, including law enforcement in Suffolk County, it is one of the most corrupt counties in the United States. And
the fact that
the police chief himself went to prison and the DA went to prison and the DA's top assistant went to prison tells you that there may be some problems. I mean, the only hope I can offer you, Donna, is that come January, there'll be a new DA there. Maybe they'll view things a bit differently, but that's awful.
But the thing is, though, Frank, I don't even need a Suffolk County DA. I need, like, a New York State prosecutor to do something. And I can't even get any – it doesn't even have to be out here. It could be, like, a New York State – someone in the city. It could be a prosecutor from the city to criminal fraud charges. But I can't get anyone to do anything.
Yeah, Donna
– I don't know what to do. I'm helpless.
Yeah,
you know?
Donna, that is a tough situation. Do me a favor. Email me the particulars of your situation, and I'll spread it to a couple of lawyers that I know and see if they have anybody that they can recommend.
I really appreciate it because I'm freaking out.
I don't blame you. That's going to be a rough Thanksgiving dinner with your brothers this year, I can tell.
Well, yeah. But hey, what's your email?
It's frank.morano, that's at frank.morano at wabcradio.com. frank.morano at wabcradio.com. But email me. I'm not promising you anything, Donna, but I will promise that I will. I have a wide network, and I will promise you that I will spread it around because I hate to see you get ripped off like that.
Well, I appreciate it because that's what I need. My lawyer said I need a prosecutor to file criminal
charges. I don't know that much about the process, but I actually had a friend. He's a lawyer, a former lawyer. He went to prison, came out of prison, and then recently he went back to prison for stealing someone else's house, and his conviction just got thrown out. So he knows about stealing houses. So I'm going to talk with my friend, who's a lawyer turned felon, and ask him what he'd recommend in a case like yours.
I appreciate it because my attorney said the civil case is finished. I can't do anything civilly.
But they said
if I can do something criminally, I have a chance.
Yeah, email me, Donna. We'll see what happens. But again, I'm not promising anything, but my heart aches for that woman. 800-848-WABC. Hey, we're going to do the $1,000 minute next. We got Kieran Lawler coming up in a few minutes as well. Marine veteran of the Iraq War, state assemblyman, great guy, lawyer as well. I mean, you talk about a guy whose parents aren't too proud of him. Marine, state assembly member, lawyer, and then you shake his hand, and he's not even trying to break your hand, but he's just so strong that you end up usually with a finger or two less whenever you shake his hand. I mean, geez. That's coming up in a few minutes. $1,000 minute. Be the seventh caller to 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-9222. And if you can answer 10 questions in 60 seconds, we'll give you an opportunity to win $1,000. You get a question wrong, you lose. 1-800-848-WABC. Seventh caller, $1,000 minute, straight ahead.
So fine, through the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you, people call, say beware doll, you're bound to fall. You thought they were all kidding you. You used to laugh about everybody that was
like a Rolling Stone. Bob Dylan, you know, a friend of mine's an attorney, and he's representing a woman who claims that Bob Dylan raped her about 60 years ago. So the other day, I asked my friend Dan, and I said, hey, you know, can we get this woman on the show to tell her story about being raped by Bob Dylan? She didn't want to come on. And you know what? You know what I resent? Not the fact that she didn't want to come on, but the fact that I suffered through five or six of my friend Dan's horribly long stories before he told me no. So he tells me all these stories, and I'm pretending to pay attention. I am paying attention. I'm not pretending. I'm nodding. Oh, okay. Oh, that's interesting. Oh. So your mom's doing that now. Oh, your brother's doing that. Oh, okay. Oh, you're going to Africa. Oh, okay. And there are other people at this event that I'm at that want my attention. And then he tells me, oh, no, she doesn't want to come on. All right. Just tell me before I invest 10 minutes or 12 minutes suffering through your story. I mean, I like Dan. Dan's a good guy, but I could have, I mean, those were a tough 10 minutes. Thankfully, I had a martini beside me. Someone who will be in a position to afford many martinis is the person that wins the $1,000 minute. And it just might be Myra in New Jersey. What is?
The Other Side of Midnight presents.
It's the $1,000 minute. Answer 10 questions correctly in 1 minute, and you could win $1,000. Here's your host, Frank Morano.
Ah, yes, the $1,000 minute, 60 seconds, 10 trivia questions. Get one wrong, you lose. Get them all right, you win. Myra is today's contestant. Hello, Myra.
Good morning, your regular super fan. We love you, and I can use $1,000.
Good. Well, I want you to win, Myra. So I don't want you to be nervous, number one. That's where people get – Carol from Jersey, she was on pace to win yesterday, and then she got tripped up on the stork. So the key is to remain calm, okay?
Right. Okay. Yes, sir.
So you're familiar with the rules of the game, right, Myra?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So the timer's going to begin after I ask you the first question. If you get a question right, I'm just moving on to the next question so that we can run through these. If you get a question wrong, Matt will play the buzzer and you lose. Hopefully you don't hear that buzzer, though. All right. Ready to go, Myra?
Yes, sir.
What part of your body is used to smell things?
My nose.
Who was Donald Trump's vice president?
Mike Pence.
What legendary DJ hosts a music show on WABC Saturday nights from 6 to 10 p.m.?
Cousin Brosi.
Which U.S. state is known for peaches?
Georgia.
In football, how many points is a field goal worth?
Wow. Now, that's where the girl that Archie. Now, I'm going to a field goal. I'm going to go with, because I'm not a football chicko, you know, but I watch it, and let's see. I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I got to say it proper. Don't be nervous. I would say the number four is coming to me. I'm wrong.
I'm sorry, Myra. It's three. You were close. You were close. I'm sorry about that, Myra. Halfway there. Take Myra's name and address, and we'll send her a complimentary The Other Side of Midnight cap. And if you want a WABC cap or any of the other WABC merchandise, you can go to WABCRadioStore.com. That's WABCRadioStore.com. A lot of great stuff on there. When I think of people that need a cap, it includes our next guest because he often needs to cover his bald spot. lot. I would never say that if he were here in studio because he is way too tough for me to ever say that in person. Assemblyman Kieran Lawler, he is a assemblyman, represents the Hudson Valley in the New York State Assembly, and a Marine veteran of the Iraq War. Assemblyman, thank you so much for joining me on the radio this morning. Happy Veterans Day.
Good morning, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Well, we couldn't do this show without giving some representation to the Marines. The Marines in our audience would never forgive me. Now, remind folks, when were you in Iraq? When did you serve there?
So I was in the Marine Corps from 2000 to 2006, and I was in Iraq in 2003, in the very first days of the Iraq War, in the invasion phase, starting in March of 2003.
Now, interestingly enough, I go on your Instagram, and people can follow your Instagram at Kieran M. Lawler, L-A-L-O-R. A lot of great stuff on there. You characterize yourself on there as an independent Republican representing the 105th District. What does that mean? Why not just say Republican? What makes you such an independent Republican?
Well, when I got elected to the assembly originally, I had to fight through the whole party process. I had to win a primary election. And as a result of that, I'm able to be very independent. The local party bosses, the state party machine, they don't influence me in any way. In fact, I'm often at odds with the party machine and the local Republican machine. And my voting record is incredibly independent. If you were to look at my voting record, there's no one else who has, gone against Republicans when that was the right thing to do, and or stood on my own when that was the right thing to do, and been the only no vote against things, for example. And I'm proud to be a Republican, but I'm also very proud to be independent and my own man.
Now, speaking of your Instagram page, do you know if you go to your Instagram, there's a link to your website. It includes your initials and then the letters NY. And if you click that link, it actually goes to a Korean porn site. Are you aware of that?
Come on.
I'm not kidding. Go to your Instagram, and if you click on the website.
I think you're not on my Instagram.
No, I'm Kieran M. Lawler, an independent Republican representing the 105th District in the New York State Assembly. And then you go to, I'm not going to say it because I don't want all these people going to this Korean porn website. Yeah. But if you click on it, it goes then to a Korean porn website, and not a very well-made one, I must say, even by Korean porn website standards.
That's very interesting to me. I don't think you're on my Instagram.
Well, then there is a Kieran Lawler impersonating you in the world of Instagram. But that's neither here nor there. Hey, what does Kieran Lawler, an elected official and a Marine veteran, do on Veterans Day?
Well, I'm scheduled to speak at a number of events around my district. And even yesterday, since there's no school today, a lot of the local high schools had Veterans Day events on the school day. So I give remarks and celebrate with my fellow veterans and celebrate with the community. And actually, I'd like to mention this. It's also my mother's 80th birthday today. My mother's birthday is Veterans Day. So I'll be going out to dinner with my mother and my three sisters and their family and my two brothers and their families. And my father was a Marine. And my brother was a Marine, so my mother, whose birthday is today, was married to a Marine and gave birth to a Marine.
Well, that was bound to happen.
Great accomplishment.
Well, happy birthday to her. I hope you guys have a great time. Now, a lot of people don't know, yesterday was the Marines' birthday, and the Marine Corps is actually even older than the United States of America, isn't it?
Yes, it is. When the country was struggling for independence, but before we actually had a country in 1775, the seat of government was in Philadelphia and in a bar, Tun Tavern. All Marines are very proud of that. In Tun Tavern, the Continental Congress passed a resolution that said we need two battalions of Marines to serve as a landing force off of our newly created Navy. So our country was born in 1776, but the Marine Corps was born in 1775. And that happened on November 10th, 1775. So that's why you saw yesterday on November 10th, everybody celebrating the Marine Corps birthday.
Now
we're 246, but we don't look a day over 245.
That's true. Talking with Kieran Lawler, you have been very vocally opposed to vaccine mandates around the state and vaccine passports and things of that nature to go into restaurants and so forth. I'm wondering, how do you think this battle over vaccine mandates is going to play out in the military? We see some Navy servicemen are suing. I imagine there's similar legal action in the other branches in the military. How do you see this playing out?
Very, very difficult. And you mentioned my time in the Marine Corps early on. Before we went to Iraq, we got the anthrax vaccine. And at that time, this is early 2003, they were giving us this anthrax vaccine. And there was some pushback to it, nothing like you're seeing now. And we were very much on a war footing and getting ready to invade a country. But there was a lot of us that were concerned about getting the anthrax vaccine then.
Was it optional or was it mandated?
No, there's nothing optional. No. It's line up and roll up your sleeve, Lawler, and we're going to jab you with this thing, which you kind of expect in the Marine Corps, especially back then. But now that same kind of attitude is being applied everywhere. And you have, you have COVID-19, which healthy people in their 20s, which is the bulk of the military, are not dramatically impacted. If they get COVID, sometimes they get it, they don't even know that they have it, or they have mild symptoms. Very few fatalities, or maybe no fatalities among healthy military age people. So you have some risk to the vaccine, and then you have very low risk to COVID for that age group that makes up most of the military. And you have people saying, a lot of female service members have called my office if they're from my district and they're serving somewhere around the country or somewhere around the world, and they're worried about fertility issues and things like that, and they don't want to get it. It's very difficult. You can't fight City Hall. You really can't fight the U.S. military. Very difficult as a service member to fight the U.S. military, but I think it should be an option. There's no longitudinal studies on this. And it's shocking to me. The biggest red flag to me is why natural immunity counts for nothing. There's a lot
of me
too. Information
that makes no sense. No sense.
The vaccine is trying to give you something close to what natural immunity gives you, but you don't get any credit in your vaccine passports. You don't get any credit for having natural immunity. And that's a huge red flag to me. And no one can answer that question. Why doesn't natural immunity count for anything when we're talking about passports and access to places and whether or not you need to get the vaccine or not?
Yeah, there was a doctor on the Cats at Night show last night. He was saying that in Israel, if you have the virus and then if you recover from it, you're good for 6 months. They green light you for 6 months and you can go everywhere that a vaccinated person can.
Yeah, I don't think there should be any access requirements for vaxxed and not vaxxed or having antibodies or not having antibodies. But if you're going to require vaccinations because you want people to have antibodies and have a resistance to COVID, then you should count natural immunity whenever you're having those kind of access conversations, which the fact that they don't, I can't wrap my head around it. No one will answer that. No one will even address it. You can't even pose that question to people. I'm a member of the New York State Assembly. I can't get anybody to answer that question in New York state government, in the federal government. No one will address that question. And the more they resist answering that question, the more it concerns me and the more suspicious I get.
Well, me too. Hey, just speaking of what's happening in New York state politics, what is this I hear about you not running for reelection next year?
Well, I ran when I originally ran in 2012. I ran on a term limits pledge. I think I'm a pretty swell guy, but I don't think that I'm indispensable. And I think the concept of the citizen legislator, much like the concept of the citizen soldier, is one of the things that makes America great. I don't think we're served well by having people in office for 20 years and 30 years. So, I'm going to finish this term in a year and 2 months, and that'll be 5 2-year terms and 10 years. And then I'm going to, drop the mic or ride off into the sunset, whatever your metaphor is, and just go back to my law practice, expand my law practice, and stand up for the concept of term limits and the citizen legislator, which I think is important. I think we need more of that. There have been big votes related to all sorts of things, and none bigger than COVID. I remember the night in March when we as a legislator handed Andrew Cuomo, disgraced Andrew Cuomo, expanded, enhanced executive powers to deal with COVID, and there were only a handful of no votes, and all your career politicians, all the people who would step over their own mother to win re-election next time, they all voted, Republicans I'm talking about, they all voted to expand Andrew Cuomo's power, even though they knew Andrew Cuomo wasn't a good guy, even though they knew it was a bad vote, because they were concerned about their next election. They were concerned about commercials being run against them in their next election. And they cast bad votes because they're so desperate to stay in office. And if you believe in term limits and the concept of the citizen legislator, you can vote your conscience. You can vote the right way. You can vote what's best for your district. And you don't have to make all those nasty, grimy political calculations before every vote because you're desperate to hang on to your seat. You can let it all hang out and do what's right. And that is so good and so lacking in all levels of government. And that's why I'm, term limiting myself.
Well, I think that's great. And, I mean, I'm going to miss you, obviously, as a rare voice of sanity in Albany. But, that's the other thing.
I'm 4:30 in the morning to talk to you, Frank.
Well, I mean, that's what makes me even more nervous, is now that you don't have to go to Albany, I'm going to be having to deal with you all the time in person.
I'm going to be calling you. I'm going to be calling in and telling you about my wills and estate problems like that lady a couple minutes ago.
Kieran Lawler, tell me how you view the statewide Republican picture next year. This was, by any objective measure, a huge win for the Republicans in New York State this year. They picked up two or three city council seats in New York City. They won the Suffolk County DA. They won the Nassau County DA. They won the Nassau County Executive. They took over the Suffolk County Legislature. They added seats to the Nassau County Legislature. They defeated three propositions that the Republican and the Conservative Party both crusaded against. They won all sorts of elections around the state. They defeated a socialist Democratic nominee for mayor of Buffalo. They look like they elected a sheriff in Erie County. I mean, up and down the state, even in New York City, a big win for the GOP this election year. What does that portend for the governor's race next year and the other statewide races next year?
Well, there's unprecedented, at least in the last 20 years, optimism for Republicans and the opportunity to win statewide and take back the governor's office next year. But the party bosses are going to do their best to mess it up, which is my concern, because this is the process that we have. The process is accelerated. It used to be the primary was in September, so we had a Republican convention around Memorial Day in the end of May, and we picked our candidate. But now the primary is in June. So we're going to pick our candidate. The party officials, at least, are going to pick their candidate in February. That's right around the corner. And they want to pick the candidate at a convention. And for a deep blue state, we have three outstanding candidates. Lee Zeldin, great candidate. Marquee candidate. Army veteran. I heard he's going to be on Bernie and Sid later on the commercial. Good guy. Know him well. Stood up for President Trump. Great congressman. Awesome that we have a candidate like that. Rob Astorino, I think, is a great candidate. Did a great job as Westchester County Executive. Is a good spokesman for Republican and conservative causes. Even Andrew Giuliani, who I don't put in the category of those other two because he's kind of, he's never held office and he's more like a name than anything else. But I'd be happy to vote for him over Kathy Hochul or Jumaane Williams or Letitia James or any of the other Democrats. So we have three good candidates. I'd say two great candidates and one other pretty good candidate running, which is great. But I think the choice should be made in a Republican primary, not in a convention where 300 party bosses get together and choose the candidate. And the party bosses don't want a primary. They don't want the 2.9 million Republicans to choose the candidate. They want 300 insiders to choose the candidate. And that's a battle that's going on right now.
Oh, no. I've been fighting that battle, as you know, for two decades in all the parties. And that seems to be the one thing that's a common thread among all the political parties is they don't really trust their actual voters. They like to do the picking themselves. What about a potential run for statewide office for you, Kieran? Attorney General, U.S. Senate, it sounds like the governor's race is pretty crowded. Maybe lieutenant governor. What do you think?
That's I definitely want to serve my community again at some point when I'm done with the assembly. But it turns out, Frank, I happen to be the world's greatest little league coach and the world's greatest youth football coach. And I'm knee deep in that, although we're now that football and baseball just ended, we have a little bit of lull in the action. But I love being at my kids' games. My daughter is a gymnast. My other daughter is an actress, and I love being at all their activities. Their ages 15, 14, 12, and 10. So I'm not looking to run around the state or be working in Washington anytime in the next 5 or 6 years while they're in the all the exciting parts of their childhood.
Well, that's very, very, very admirable. Kieran, I appreciate the time this morning. Happy Veterans Day. I appreciate you joining me, and I'll look forward to seeing you in person soon and talking to you even sooner.
Yeah, and Frank, what's up with your audience? How did that lady not know that a field goal is 3 points? She could have won $1,000.
I don't know what to tell you. I don't know what to say. I'm just glad you didn't call in before her.
I could use $1,000. I have 4 kids.
I bet. You're going to be out of work soon. Kieran.
No, I have a law practice.
I'm just kidding. Kieran, I'll talk with you soon, my friend. Assemblyman Kieran Lawler. Appreciate the time. Yes, the great Edwin Starr singing War, What Is It Good For? A lot of people don't know. That was the original title of the novel, War and Peace, by Leo Tolstoy. So if you didn't know that, now you know. At least that's what I heard from Seinfeld. Now, 800-848-9222, it is time for you to be heard for 15 seconds. It's time for
The Other Side of Midnight. This is 15 Seconds of Fame.
Roller is in New Jersey.
Yeah, Frank, I just want to say thanks to all the veterans. God bless them. And if somebody knows one or sees one today, buy them a cup of coffee and tell them thank you. Also, Gary should be unbanned from the radio at WABC. And the people should stop boycotting New York if they're going to demand vaccines or unvaccinated. I think it's time to use the word boycott.
Joe in Orange County.
Thanks to all the veterans. I'm a first responder for 9/11. And we all have problems down there because Rudy Giuliani lied to us that the air was safe. Okay, we need more guys like Kieran Law running for office.
Thank you, Joe. I think that was more of a Christy Whitman thing, but they'll let people make their own judgments. Raji is in Manhattan.
Rumors are still circulating at Christie's and Red Apple that the early news is to extend to 7 a.m. For late risers. And my favorite, Juliet and Lydia, to co-host the two-hour show of their own. Please verify.
I wouldn't hold my breath. Aldo in the Bronx. Hello.
The hard left is a cult of human misery. When the hard left takes control of the money printing press in this country, the sky's the limit for the illegal aliens.
The WABC early news is next. We have a ton of great news coming your way. And it's Veterans Day. We've got a lot of great Veterans Day programming all day long. Keep your radio dial locked here on 77 WABC. Early news is next. To be continued.